Ladies and gentlemen, the reason we're late is we're waiting for a quorum. So no, just stay in talking because we can't start until we get our quorum. quorum, and we're going to start. I apologize for being a little late, but one more member from Blacksburg. I hope Dr. Barrett will come, but we should start now that we have a quorum. So the first order is to approve the minutes from the meeting on December the 17th. They should be in your packets, Mr. Pollack and Dr. Harrison. Does anyone have any changes they want to make to the minutes? All right. Do you have a motion to approve?
So moved.
So moved. Second? All right. Great. Moved and seconded, and we'll move on to the content for today. So we first are going to hear from C.A. Sparks. You haven't met C.A. She works for VITA, and she is staffing this position for one meeting, I understand. And then we are waiting for Todd and Sam to identify who our staff person will be since Nicole Hellman-Toler left. We didn't drive her away, though. It's my understanding she actually enjoyed the role.
Yes, she enjoyed the role very much. Because I am acting in this capacity, I don't have a lot of official reporting to do, but I do want to announce to you that we're taking the HITSAC meeting on the road. So the August 11th, 2016 meeting will be held at the Conference Center of Innova Center for Personalized Health up in Fairfax, Virginia. And the November 10th meeting, 2016, will be held at the Virginia Biocomplexity Institute in Blacksburg, Virginia.
And the reason for doing that, after having met here for 5 years in a row, would be to see other institutions that are involved with informatics and for interoperability for the state. I think they'll be very interesting meetings. So make your plans to be able to come to the Fairfax, Virginia for August 11th and Blacksburg for November the 10th. They both will be public meetings, of course, in the conference center at the Center for Personalized Health and at a conference facility inside the Biocomplexity Institute. All right. Any other topic you want to cover?
No, that is it for today.
All right. Well, then we're going to turn our attention to Debbie Condrey's report from VDH for an update. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ruffin. Good morning, everybody. So, got a few slides. Okay. I don't have the clicker.
Thank you, Mr. Chopra. Let the minutes show that he intervened to help the meeting progress.
Oh, there we go. Just keep pressing buttons until it works. Just like my car and my TV. Okay, so I wanted to just provide a few updates on some of the projects that the health department has governance over, is responsible for. Michael, I think, is going to speak, Michael Matthews, a little bit to some of the activities with Connect Virginia, so I won't go in into a lot of detail on this, other than to add, just to mention a couple of things, which I think we have another, I have another slide on, but the Advanced Directive Registry, which Virginia has had for several years now, was transitioned from Unival, which is a nonprofit out of Michigan, to Connect Virginia and U.S. Living Wills. And that was successfully transferred and stood up on April 8th. And I'm happy to say that it went off without a hitch or a hiccup, and folks are still able to access all of their records. And it was a really great collaboration and job on everybody's behalf. So my thanks in particular to Sandy McLeese and to Michael and to the folks at U.S. Living Will who really, and my team as well, who really stepped up and worked together in a really tight time frame to make sure that no one missed having access to their advanced directives. So a very good thing on that behalf. I think with some of the extra functionality we'll have with this registry through U.S. Living Wills and Connect Virginia, we'll see a lot of uptake in those using it. We are having some conversations with U.S. Living Wills about the advanced directives they already have in their system and connecting the two. We've also had some conversations, Michael and I especially, through the EDM Forum and the Richmond Academy of Medicine on their Honoring Choices initiative to sort of look at the possibility of a statewide advanced directive registry. So this may be an opportunity for us to work together and make that happen in Virginia, which would be a really great thing.
Well, actually, excuse my ignorance. I assumed it already was statewide.
It is a statewide registry. It is not a, it's a registry that the citizens can use. Virginia's Advanced Directive Registry is a statewide registry citizens can use to upload your own documents. What we're considering with this group is a recommendation that hospitals standardize on this kind of system as well. And because it's with U.S. Living Wills now, U.S. Living Wills is in a lot of hospital systems, that might be an easier way to go. So when Sandy and Michael and I have met with the Honor and Choices folks, we've been given some presentations on how this happens within an electronic health record now at VCU system, Bon's Core, HCA, different folks did some presentations on those. And it varies across hospital systems. I'd say Bon's Core probably has a little bit more sophistication around it, but it is in most of the, and even in Bon's Core, in most of the locations, hospital systems, it is by event and it's not by patient. So you go to the ED five times, you might have five different advanced directives on file. And then once they put the advanced directive into their system, almost all of them said it's very hard to get it back out. So they asked for another one. So it's by the event or the incident or the reason you're visiting the hospital rather than by the patient. The advanced directive registry statewide is by patient. So there's some conversations that are ongoing there that I think will be very helpful as we move forward with that collaboration with Honoring Choices and those folks. So we'll keep everybody posted on that.
Well, actually, that sounds terrific. It sounds like it's HITSEC might have a role in promulgating those standards.
Absolutely, there would be a role. And we've talked with the group, the Honoring Choices group, about the HIT standards that have already been promulgated having to do with health information technology standards. I don't think we're quite there, but when we get to an agreement on how this might work, what we'd like to do is bring it to the group to talk about the standards that would apply to an advanced directive registry and then get your approval on that.
Terrific. Thank you.
We continue with Connect Virginia. I'll mention also to work on the prescription drug monitoring program from this year's General Assembly session, obviously, and from the different initiatives having to do with opiate and opioid abuse. It's critical that we make that system as accessible as possible. We've had some conversations with the vendor that works on the prescription monitoring program. It's part of the Department of Health Professions. But what we've done so far is just sort of provided the link from the Connect Virginia website to the prescription monitoring program. I've also had some conversations just this morning about with the medical society and about combining some things within one portal so that physicians don't have to click out of an EHR and go back to another link and click out of that and go back to something else. So from a workflow perspective, it's still challenging. So we're still working through that. So Connect Virginia continues to work with us, the Department of Health, on the bidirectional immunization data exchange. Next will be the cancer registry and the bidirectional pathway there. Fortunately, with this work, once the technology is put in place to do bidirectional work, it's easy to transfer it to different types of systems. So immunizations will be first, especially to meet MU3. I think Michael, I think he's going to talk a little bit about some of the changes within Med Virginia and so forth. But we've discussed lately some sort of a business framework for Connect Virginia, and to sort of figure out what are the foundational pieces and the foundational services that Connect Virginia will offer, and then what might be those value-added services. And some of this work, like the Advanced Directive Registry and counter alerts, we've added to these are the foundational services that the Connect Virginia will offer. Encounter alerts are obviously the admissions, discharges, and transfers, which has been pretty successful. So Michael might talk a little bit about that.
Would you mind if we go back one slide, because I have a question to ask about newborn screening.
Mm-hmm.
When do you think, and this may be a question for Dr. Tony, but when do you think we'll see, VDH with VITA already discussing ways of incorporating genetic information into newborn screening?
off on May 25th. DCLS has secured some grant funding that we're able to put some work forward on the newborn screening side, and we have had some conversations with DCLS about the genetics component of this as well. As you know, Dr. Ruffin, that's a little bit of a different endeavor for us because of the amount of data involved there. I mean, we already get a great deal of data, but the amount of data involved there and the storage pieces are difficult.
What I may do then, anticipating Aaron Black's discussion this afternoon, is ask Aaron to spend a little bit of time on the data requirements you think the Commonwealth would need for, say, pharmacogenomic testing of neonates. INOVA has started pharmacogenomic testing of neonates, and Aaron's right at the center trying to figure out how to store the data. So, thank you.
Perfect. Okay. We'd like to hear about that. Okay, the next project I'll mention is the All Payer Claims Database, and this is a slide that you typically see in the packet just about every time we meet, and that's just sort of a description of what the All Payer Claims Database is. I will mention again that this is a project that is managed and governed by the Department of Health, but it is it functions through the Virginia Health Information Group with Michael Lundberg as the executive director, and it's doing quite well. So I think I mention this just about every time, but for this size All Payer Claims Database, it was stood up in pretty record time, so I think we're all very proud of that functionality they provide.
Could I ask a question there on that too? And I probably should know the answer to this, but I'm perfectly happy to admit my ignorance. I know the data are de-identified for patients, but do we have a master person index of any kind that allows us to associate claims for the same person, even though it's de-identified, across payers?
Yes, we do.
So is it Initius that we're using, or what?
No, it's we use Milliman, and MedInsight is the analytics tool.
Okay.
But there is a patient identifier. There's a physician identifier. Now, we all know that the physician identifiers, and sometimes patients as well,
right.
Especially the provider identifier, you know, it might look like we have 10 million physicians in Virginia when we know we don't.
Right.
So that's the part of the provider registry that we've been working on with Department of Health Professions to try to offer that. But the data actually comes in through the payers as raw identified data. It goes out as the identified aggregated data. But there is an identifier that allows you to match up a patient with the identifiers associated with that patient, check other companies or insurance plans to see if they had any claims with that person, those health plans as well.
But the logic is coming from MedInsight.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Update on where we are. We have about 200 users of the MedInsight platform now. We have about 75 of those at Department of Health. We are receiving quarterly updates from the participants. I'd remind everyone that the Virginia's All Payer Claim Database is a volunteer system, so it is not mandatory that health plans participate, which can be challenging. But we are doing quite well. I think we've got about the legislation calls for us to collect claims information on 75% of covered lives, and we're right about 72% or so. So we're pretty well there. And we have done multiple rounds of reporting using the APC data, as we've mentioned there, choosing wisely within Virginia, in partnership with Beth Sports at VCHI, is something that's been part of the SIM grant. And just a couple other pieces of just sort of the status of some things that have happened with the APCD that I included on this slide that you can read. More updates on APCD. So there's been a lot of work going on. We have, it seems like in the last couple of months, really received quite an uptick in interest in the All Payer Claims Database, especially from some other states, which is interesting. I'll just mention quickly the challenge around that is that there are very specific reasons for requesting and receiving information from the All Payer Claims Database through the legislation. In order to address those types of requests, we have an All Payer Claims Database Advisory Committee. That committee actually meets on Monday to discuss those requests for data and to approve or deny them. So this is not something that's done in a vacuum with just VHI. why we make sure we pass this across all of the stakeholders and everyone's comfortable with the data being released. Just a couple of additional updates. VDH has hired a full-time informatics data governance program manager who starts on Monday. I'm very excited about that. Some of you might remember that Joe Grubbs was sort of in that role before, and so we finally managed to, after three rounds of interviewing, we managed to secure someone who I think will be quite good for Department of Health and for the state as well. His role will be to work with the Department of Health to continue to establish our data governance policies and do some organizational development around that. He comes from VCU. He comes from VCU, and he has an excellent background in data management and data governance, so I think he'll do quite well.
So, Mr. Pollack, you vouch for him, do you?
Finally, wanted to mention that with the through Vital Records, which I've mentioned a few times, we've had several projects like our collaboration with Ancestry, our electronic death registration system, which won a national NASIO award. But we did recently receive some additional funding through a grant for Vital Records to promulgate the use of the electronic death registration system and to do some additional functionality on that and some marketing and also some data quality and visit with each hospital system and talk with the, folks about the death information that's coming out of the hospital, the funeral homes, and et cetera, so that we can improve the quality of our data. Vital Records is going to be hiring two field reps, which will be data experts and not necessarily based in any geographic locations. So Dr. Ruffin, expect a field rep from Vital Records to come and visit at Inova Hospital to talk with you all about your data quality and on the mortality side. And hopefully we can, we have to report, as you all know, we have to report all of this data to the NCHS, the National Center for Health Statistics. So our goal every year is to ensure that we are submitting data as accurately as we possibly can. So we've recognized over time that some of these data quality issues that we see continuing probably need some one-on-one support and help. So these field reps will be a start on that.
Have a measurement of the data quality you're getting from each institution now?
We do.
Can you send me our ANOVA grades?
I would be happy to.
Thank you.
And then I think that's it for me. Yep.
Well, thank you very much. Are there questions for Ms. Condry? All right, thank you. That was a nice update. All right, now we're going to turn our attention to Anish Chopra. Mr. Chopra has rejoined the Commonwealth, and he's caught the buzzer, caught it. So Anish is a strong advocate for fire, the fire standards, and we're lucky to have Anish here to make recommendations for the Commonwealth. We don't intend to vote on the recommendations today. We're going to ruminate on them after your persuasive presentation. But I expect we'll certainly take it up again in August. But you have the podium and the floor. Welcome.
Sir, well, thank you so much for having me. And I think Debbie's presentation really echoes the importance of this moment in time where national standards are in some ways offering more opportunities for many of the challenges that Debbie described being on the immediate horizon, not only in the future horizon, which is a very exciting opportunity.
I'm negligent. I should point out to the audience that you, as much as anyone, were the reason that HITSAC was created, and we are grateful for your
interest. I would say that would be Delegate Nixon and Governor Kane. But yes, I appreciate the I played a minor staff support role to bring this idea to life. And in fact, that was my first slide, Marshall.
Go.
The history.
Yep.
The background. The reason why I was excited to visit. I wanted to begin the conversation by, in many ways, closing the loop on what the policy intention was back at the origin. If you recall, this was essentially the healthcare innovation framework. By the end of the Kane administration, we had established a public-private partnership for information exchange on administrative transactions, which I don't know if it still exists, Debbie, but it did at the time. We'll see if it still exists. We decided that it would be important for the Commonwealth to have a voice on procurement standards as opposed to what the federal government was doing, regulating the private sector. So you had this yin and yang where the federal government would regulate standards meant for the rest of the world, but then the Commonwealth, representing the voice of the customer, the agencies that were making electronic health record purchases, could be a little bit more specific. So you have this broader statement about national policy that then would feed into a loop that would say, well, how do we make this real for the actual technical standards we'd want to make available, which then could also feed the federal government's agenda on what standard gaps exist, which could then feed back new policy. And that virtuous cycle in many ways was at the heart of House Bill 2044 that gave us HITSAC. And then obviously we had a larger vision that the care delivery system that was operating at the moment in time was evolving. And my goodness, you could say that the next 3 to 5 years we'll see the most dramatic change in how we deliver care. And IT never leads those conversations, but it should be a fast supporter. And that virtuous cycle, again, comes into play. We had an executive order, which I guess still stands until the governor withdraws it. So I'm presuming, Debbie, we still have Executive Order 42 on the books, which promotes basically tech-enabled innovations to improve the lot in life for state employees and other stakeholders. So I just wanted to set the stage in this discussion about where we are on the FHIR API. And I thought this slide, I'm going to take a moment on this slide, Marshall, because this clarifies federal policy. I think there's been a misunderstanding and a lack of clarity in the national debate about what is information exchange. And ONC, and it's still policy to this day until they change it, has defined information exchange standards as a portfolio. No one magic bullet to solve all use cases. And the portfolio has three dimensions. The first dimension, perhaps the easiest dimension, was the notion of point-to-point secure messaging, what we referred to as the direct protocol. And direct is required since stage two of meaningful use. I don't know if HITSAC has made a comment about direct as a feature for all state purchase services, but it is a requirement at the federal level for meaningful use, stage two. The second option, query-based exchange, really had been the heart of the two federally funded HIEs that we had in Virginia, one that's now evolved in the MedVirginia program, and then obviously the one that had fallen short, CareSpark, down in Southwest Virginia. Query-based exchange is exactly as what Debbie was alluding to in the Connect Virginia model, that there is a technical and legal and policy framework that would allow institutions to share information based on consented access rights. What I would think of as a B2B model, where the access and consumer consent are represented by stakeholders, may not be a direct voice of the patient. And query-based exchange has been broadly necessary for all the interoperability requirements, but this is an important point, not regulated as a standard in meaningful use. Not regulated. The federal government in the first term when I was chief technology officer proposed regulation to require these capabilities, a governance rule for how it would work. That rule was withdrawn with 96% of public comment in opposition to the proposed regulation. An important challenge in that it's a part of the portfolio, but to this day remains the unregulated part of the portfolio. Third, and the reason for the discussion on the FHIR API, is that the model of the consumer having the right to aggregate their own health information and to share its use among stakeholders. Frankly, as Debbie pointed out, Virginia was the pioneer in that model when we created the Advanced Healthcare Directives Registry. We made it consumer-mediated at the outset. That was how it was designed. And that idea was very there had been no industry standards. So people would allow for your downloading of a text file. You could download a CCDA, which is a standard, but the method by which you access that CCDA was not for authentication and authorization. So it became the, it had been a path on the portfolio, but it had only been operationalized at the federal level through programs where we ran them, the Medicare Blue Button Program, the VA Blue Button Program, again, non-standardized. Meaningful Use Stage 3 introduces the first requirement of an API standard for consumer-mediated exchange. To make it in really simple terms for everyone else in the room, that means instead of a human being logging into a patient portal, a human being can designate a machine to log in for them. This introduces challenges, which I'll talk about momentarily. That is, how do we know the machine represents the human? And what is the method by which we transmit sensitive health information to the machine? In anticipation of this regulation, HL7 and a stakeholder community of the willing, if you will, formed a collaborative called the Argonaut Project. No federal role involved directly, but most of the major EHR vendors, Epic, Cerner, Athena, McKesson, etc., all jointly funded this collaborative to distill a common, open industry standard that meets the requirements for Stage 3 meaningful use. The FHIR API constrained by the Argonaut Project implementation guide will be finalized in June for anyone to use. In other words, Marshall, it becomes a candidate for consideration. Right now there is nothing. FHIR is everything. This particular implementation guide becomes, and of course it's published now, but it's being tested and iterated until the consensus bodies endorse the implementation guide. It meets the very specific quote at the bottom of the page, which is exactly what a Stage 3 certified health IT product must offer. Why I mention that is that the federal regulatory framework has itself evolved. Meaningful use as it relates to physicians has now essentially been changed into a new program called Advancing Care Information as part of the macro legislation for physician provider payments. That too carried forward this very same open API requirement, which means all Stage 3 certified electronic health vendors must be adopted by any provider that wishes to get paid as part of the macro legislation, which means 2018 and 2019 are critical adoption years. You literally, whether you wanted meaningful use incentive payments or not, is now irrelevant. If you want to get paid as a doctor performing your services with any of those incentive, which is basically 20% of your income, you will have to have a Stage 3 certified EHR. All Stage 3 certified EHRs must attest to an open API that meets this requirement. But to the point of this committee, no technical standard has been identified. It is up to each individual vendor to disclose the method by which they wish to promulgate, which leaves a choice for the buyer, in this case the Commonwealth of Virginia, for EHRs it intends to purchase, and grants and so forth, to determine whether it wishes to speak for a common standard or to let vendors dictate the standards. That's the gap that this particular committee might wish to engage on. So to get you a little bit more detail, I attempted, as I could, to read the RTIP report to look at specific projects that are underway that would have implications of this functionality. Again, on the left, I've included the language that defines the certification criteria. That is, you must provide that machine login application access to what's called the Common Clinical Dataset. Now, it's interesting, Debbie's comment about the advanced directives. In the CCDA, the advanced directive is a kind of a standardized item for the public to access. So a consumer has access through the CCDA to a standard.
standardized copy of their advanced directive. It is not in the common clinical data set. It's one of those voluntary things. So, again, HITSEC may choose, because the advanced directive, I'm ad-libbing based on the fact that you have one and you're going live on new features, you may voluntarily say, we would like the advanced care directive standard to be accessible, again, in application. You know, you can go beyond the common clinical data set to say, that meets our requirements, we want that to also have an API. And that, right now, there are no, to the best of my knowledge, FHIR API intensive efforts to standardize advanced directives. I guess you could call it is being done as a document access. You can put any document through the system, so you can just call it a document. But if you wanted to read the underlying information, that today is not standardized. So that's the information on the left. What are the relevant applications that I've witnessed from the 2015 RTIP report? Well, there are two major EHR projects, at least one of whom is MU certified. And that's the behavioral health, whatever the new name of Demerstat is. What is it now called? Something? Whatever? That, yes. This agency is in the midst of an EHR procurement. It has been MU2 certified, I would imagine. And the question, obviously, for this body is, what will its strategy be to be MU3 certified? Because that project is still ongoing. Does it intend to be Stage 3 certified? And if so, is that part of the RTIP review? There was no language whatsoever in the RTIP about how we transition from a Stage 2 to a Stage 3. But you could imagine VITA might have a role in tracking that criteria. The Department of Corrections is also listed as having a desire to purchase an electronic health record. No indication as to whether they've done the procurement, have begun implementation, and whether they intend to have a meaningful use certified product. But it is noted as an electronic health record, which would fall under the HB 2044, which creates HITSEC. What standards would you impose? Obviously, a candidate here would be Stage 3 certification. In addition to this, MMIS modernization is obviously the biggest project in the health domain. I don't know where we are on procurement, but I presume we're in the middle of it. I did find one of the requirements in it is, in fact, to create member portals that support one-stop-shop objective and improve information access and service for all Medicaid-related needs. Sounds a heck of a lot like patient-facing API access. If it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, maybe it's a duck, and it's a candidate for our consideration. As an example, New York State, in their MMIS, has required a patient-facing view, download, and transmit capability. And so their vendor has actually implemented that capability now. And of course, today it's just view, download, and transmit. My presumption is that New York State, like Virginia, would be governing through Stage 3 and what that evolution looks like. It's just not clear from any of the materials publicly reported whether HITSEC has made any commentary on the alignment of that requirement to an industry standard.
HITSEC has not commented yet.
I think the procurement's happening. I don't know when it's happening, but it's happening, and it's happening, I think, now. It's an RFI.
RFI.
Perfect.
At the moment.
Perfect. So the last one, this is my personal bugaboo, because I chaired the Section 1561 that promulgated these standards. This is not so much specific to FHIR. This is the Eligibility Modernization EDSP program, which falls under the Affordable Care Act, which meant to standardize electronically. If you apply to healthcare.gov, you should repurpose your application for SNAP, TANF, employment services, and the like. Secretary Sebelius at the time embraced the recommendations for standards called Section 1561, which at the center of those recommendations was that the consumer should mediate that information sharing. And I've seen no reference to 1561 in any Virginia document. It is my bugaboo. I am hopeful that that is either a misunderstanding or something, but that standard is in the regulation. If HITSEC weighs in on whether it's meeting the standard for our procurements or not is an open question. But again, the idea of consumer-mediated is there's a portal. I can log in. I can see my information, and I can allow it to be reused by other applicants. Yes, Debbie?
So, there is a system that's stood up to address this. It's called Common Help, And you can access that. Anyone can go to that, Google it, and get to it. The Department of Social Services, DMAS, Department of Health, and others worked on. And it's a common API that allows an
For internal purposes?
Nope, for external purposes, for customers to use to start their application for services.
So this is a great new information. What standards did we use to determine that API level access to patients, if not the FHIR API?
It's a custom standard that was approved by HITSAC, actually, several years ago. CA is nodding, so she remembers that. I don't remember exactly. That was not in my area. It was more on the Department of Social Services side. But we could certainly find that out, but it should be in our documentation for HITSAC.
I think that's an example of the purpose of why HITSAC was created, to default to industry-accepted standards to avoid as many proprietary standards as possible. So as that program evolves, maybe it too can fall in line with industry adopted. That's excellent. There are emerging applications, and with Aaron on the agenda, I couldn't resist to include a slide on precision medicine, and Marshall, with your leadership. While the Commonwealth may not have an immediate RTIP project, your point about newborn screening and potentially incorporating genetic, I just wanted to make sure that everyone was aware. The FHIR API may not be named in the meaningful use regulation. It is named in the Think for Science program that NIH has funded. So let me be precise about what this is and what it is not. In February of 2016, just 2 months ago, President Obama announced a series of commitments and public-private partnerships to encourage patients to directly enroll in the National Precision Medicine Cohort. It is intended to be a million patient cohort, and something between 30% and 40% are expected to come directly. That is to say, Rich, if I'm a patient at VCU, whether VCU itself is a coordinating body for precision medicine is irrelevant. I may take my data from the VCU portal and enroll directly with the NIH so that my information can be connected. This is very much tied to a desire to have the cohort look like America, rural, urban, African-American, variety of ethnicities and backgrounds, and that this direct enrollment functionality would be supported by Stage 3 certified EHRs. Voluntarily, Epic, Cerner, Athena, McKesson, Allscripts, Dr. Chrono, and eClinicalWorks, 7 vendors, will ship later this year a FHIR API version of their patient portals to systems that voluntarily choose to become alpha sites. It may be small, 100 patients here, 100 patients there. It's possible there may be institutions in Virginia that wish to be that voluntary site, in which case we would have the FHIR API to the patient-designated apps capability, at least in prototype, in use by the end of this calendar year. And it performs the exact functions that are required under Stage 3, but is specified to the common open API. In other words, while Epic may certify a proprietary Epic API to meet the requirements for meaningful use, it will conform to the open API, as will Cerner. In other words, two versions of the software will be available. And as HITSAC making recommendations, one could say, should we make the open version the one that we want to buy to drive to industry standardization? And exactly to my comment about the Argonaut project, all of the iterations of how that standard will evolve and so forth is being done, built on the Argonaut project community.
So forgive what may sound like a naive question, but given the fact that these vendors are creating two separate APIs...
You're right.
Why wouldn't they abandon the proprietary...
No, I don't work for them. And you're right, Marshall. The reason I'm so motivated to encourage the Commonwealth to engage is the more that the voice of customers say, I want to buy that version, the reality, Marshall, is you're going to live in two worlds, because the data model for the APIs that are within each vendor will go far beyond this minimum common data set. So my hope for the industry is that there should be plenty of competition and proprietary and profit-making and all the rest for all the things that are outside of the meaningful use common clinical data set. But we all agree that when I ask for my meds list from Rich and I ask for my meds list from Marshall, the app, the machine that's logging in, can compute the same decision support calculator because they're the same meds list. Irrespective of whether the source system is Cerner or the source system is Epic, the transformation of that raw data into a vocabulary that is common semantically, accessible via the API, that's the work of the Argonaut Project and what Think for Science has committed to do voluntarily.
Would you remind us, does the Argonaut Project define the reference terminologies for each data element?
The great news is those have been part of what the ONC has organized under the Data Access Framework going back 10 plus years. So the debate about RX norm for meds list and SNOMED CT for problem list is an open, transparent, collaborative process that's been underway, just not formalized in regulation beyond the meaningful use common data set. So that process is the evolving, ongoing process to get to the dream, semantic harmonization of common information. We're not there perfectly, but we have a framework. The second emerging application I wanted to bring to the group's attention is that it has been reported that DMAS will be participating in the Accountable Health Community's CMS grant. This program is competitive, so it's not clear Virginia will win, but there are at least 4 or 5 communities in the Commonwealth that have a reasonable chance of competing to do something pretty remarkable. To establish a common patient profile, not just across doctors and hospitals, but to include Meals on Wheels and weight training and other social support services, that a bridge organization would be granted some funding from the federal government to determine whether keeping a unified screening assessment for every The rules essentially call for a majority of the Medicare and Medicaid population to be screened in these communities, and that information be made available writ large across the ecosystem. So the challenge or the opportunity here is, again, it's not in the RTIP report, but DMAS is contractually going to participate in this effort. By what standards will DMAS provide, for example, beneficiary-level data access to the bridge organization so that they can help screen beneficiaries? I might humbly suggest that the same idea, let the consumer connect their beneficiary data from DMAS and connect it to the bridge if they chose, falls very neatly with a number of policies. I will point out, by the way, unless my friends in Richmond can tell me otherwise, our laws remain on the books that any data held by the government requested by the patient, the consumer, the individual in Virginia, we are legally obligated to provide it to them. Now, it does not say in a FHIR API, but that core premise that my data is available to me is in law in Virginia, and it may speak to questions like how does a Medicaid beneficiary demand or request beneficiary-level data, and can it be in a machine-readable form so that the bridge organization can help coordinate their care? As an example of the relationship to HITSAC. Last emerging application, there are physician groups in the Commonwealth who have already been selected to participate in the Million Hearts Innovation Model. This is a program that is designed to help patients at risk of a heart attack have a quarterback for their care, maintain and monitor their information flow. One of the problems is that the physician that's deemed the quarterback may not actually have the last blood pressure reading to determine whether or not there's elevated risk. That patient may be seen in many locations, including, by the way, a Walmart kiosk. So how the risk calculator is performed under contract by CMS remains an open question for HITSAC to consider whether information about those individuals in the Medicaid program, how that information should flow back to the quarterback in this case to ensure that blood pressure monitoring takes hold. Again, another significant candidate for the FHIR API in being the beneficiary making the decision that I'd like to connect my quarterback to my Walmart kiosk information, or whatever the situation may be. I'll end with a couple of observations about what's happening about the role of an entity like HITSAC to support organizations, ensure that they have the right standards language in contracts. Here's draft language for all EHR RFPs made available by smarthealthit.org. As history, this is the entity that received $15 million of R&D funding by ONC to initiate what is now the FHIR API, what's referred to as Smart on FHIR. It's the version of FHIR that has a simple internet access model, OAuth2, on the front end, and it is the combined technical specification is the Argonaut project standard. So this is an example of an open source document that HITSAC could recommend be adopted, improved, enhanced, what have you, to ensure that programs that are in the midst of procurement have access to this information. Obviously, I had to bleed in with some broader statements about Virginia's leadership here. To me, we have historically been leaders in open data, all the way back to Mr. Jefferson himself, who is the pioneer of open data. My successor and the president has formalized APIs as standard requirement for all data sets access to the public, and that formula is one that I assume Vita is considering as well. You will obviously be sensitive to security risks.
Dwell a little bit on the last comment. Because I think that's quite interesting, and I'm unfamiliar with it. The White House playbook?
Yes. So open data was the first assignment I was handed as CTO. And we put forward a set of regulations, which have become, not regulations, directives, which have become executive order, which is the force of law within agencies. And that force of law requires agencies, and this is the quote, all agencies must provide data sets to the public in their entirety, not just through bulk downloads, but now through APIs. And you saw the news yesterday, 18F, a division of the federal government, is standardizing a common username and password authentication layer to access information. And with Dave Verhoff in the audience, my presumption is DMV is not far behind in offering a service that can do something similar for access to Commonwealth APIs. But again, executive order run by the administration, again, the kind of policy instrument that HITSAC is in a position to influence when it comes to API.
I'm going to ask a follow-on question.
Of course. So this is your time.
Well, and we're grateful that you're here.
Whatever.
When will our Congress permit us to have a unique identifier for each citizen?
It won't. You'd have to change the law.
I understand.
Will they change it?
The law is explicit that we will not have one.
So this question, this is the heart of the consumer-mediated path. The president asked his Science and Technology Council, PCAS, to study the issue of can we achieve interoperability and the learning health system without a national patient identifier. And this group of experts published in December of 2010 that you do not need a unique patient identifier. And part of the reason for that is if the consumer does the mediation, you may call me 11101, and at VCU, I'm 31204. But I have a username and password to you, and I have a username and password to you, and I can connect the two using the FHIR API. You're agnostic as to how each of you refer to me in your institutions. You just know that I've authorized the two of you to share my common record. Commonwealth of Virginia entity. If I wrote a letter saying I'd like a copy of everything you have on me. Derived, enriched, enhanced, whatever it may be. Under the current Commonwealth of Virginia, under the Records Act or whatever they called it, I'm allowed to petition to get my own data in whatever form you give it to me. It can be a PDF, it can be a letter, it can be whatever. That is a separate conversation than what the national regulations are on patient-level data. So, meaningful use is just the facts, ma'am. No interpretation required. Labs, meds, problem list, as they're in your systems, you must provide. It is your choice whether you want to provide additional enrichments and insights back. That's entirely up to you. The purpose of why I'm encouraging the FHIR API is you can extend the model and add whatever additional insight you want because the payload just carries it on. So you might have a relationship with ANOVA to say, gosh, we'd love to get the genetic summary as a data element in the proffered information. Not required, but we'll simply add it to what the API can already deliver. It's a lot easier to add stuff when there's already a connection point linking two systems than it is to have a whole new point-to-point interfaces for each derived value is what got us into this problem in the first place. Now, from a security standpoint, I will make the following observation, and I'll even suggest on the Advanced Directives Registry. We do not know as a country if a human or a machine is logging into the portal, any portal. And we saw this firsthand as I was leaving the White House. IRS implemented a version of Blue Button called Get Transcript, which allowed Americans to get 3 years of their tax history. 23 million Americans downloaded their tax history in electronic format. Very powerful, the most widely popular data set ever made available to consumers, not through API, but through traditional download features. But about 200,000 machines faking themselves as people went in, spoofed the identity because they could answer the questions from Experian or whatever it was, and the net result was that there was not a hack. People came in through the front door. They just spoofed the front door, and there was no method for the agency to determine. So when we think about security, an API is leapfrog better because you know which application got the key, and you log when and how it was accessed. So the door for the human is still a mess, but the door for machines, a heck of a lot easier to manage and control. And by the way, this is how the internet economy works. Every single day, billions of APIs are transacted between Amazon, Google, Facebook, etc., to their connected applications, all tracked, monitored, evaluated for misbehavior on the analytics front, etc. So I actually argue, and you'll see this in the White House, in the ONC Security Task Force for APIs, that APIs are dramatically more secure than the current username and password logins. Finally, you know, this is our history. We are leaders. I go back to from the Warner administration to the Kane years, into McDonnell and into McAuliffe. We've consistently been a pioneer on electronic health records. Open access, collaboration, improving care models. Every region of the Commonwealth has some amazing story that they can attach to. This is a slide at the end of our tenure that has only been built upon since. And that's our chance. Do we want to continue that leadership role or sit back and wait for others to dictate? To me, the purpose of HITSEC is a voice that could be really market-moving and engaging by demonstrating, to your point, Marshall, let's have the open API for MU Common. We don't want a lot of proprietary versions so we can get ahead of this problem. I'll end with this final comment. Before I left the White House, I issued an innovation challenge. No one in the Commonwealth won, but I will say something fascinating. The winner, one of the winners, was the YMCA. And the YMCA tested whether an entirely new diabetes prevention program could improve outcomes. And under the Affordable Care Act, that experiment, if endorsed by the actuary as having improved outcomes and lowered costs, can be made available as a payment model for the entire country without Congress. And the quote at the bottom of the page is the actuary saying that the YMCA Diabetes Prevention Program achieved ROI, and so Secretary Burwell announced she's going to make that option available to everyone, including the Commonwealth. People can now get diabetes prevention starting next year, and it's an example of going on offense. Any one of of these open questions on advanced directives, on anything, we can promote a model that gets us the leadership opportunity that we have always been in making this stuff work. Thank you for your time. If there's any other questions, I'm happy to be here and do whatever you want for the agenda.
No, we have time for questions. Thank you.
All right, all you.
Dr. Barrett? Would you mind moving the mic closer to you?
Sort of push the boundary here on this derivative data. So in your scenario here with Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones, Mr. Smith have access to the data that limits his care.
Okay, go one level deeper.
Okay, so Mr. Jones would be, if you have the implication is here, if there's a limited amount of either money or pharmaceutical to treat high blood pressure in this example, that even though maybe Mr. Jones would benefit from it, he would benefit marginally less than Mr. Smith, and under the constraint of either money or something, so you would send the medication to Mr. Smith.
Yes.
And so this is based on data from Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones.
Yes.
As well as others.
Yes.
So in this, when you have, it could be antivirals, it could be vaccines,
yes.
It could be lots of things. In this situation,
excellent question.
You restrict data to Mr. Smith and Mr. Smith, Mr. Jones, and Mr. Jones objects.
Yes.
Does he have access to the data that influenced his decision under these, because this is data relevant to his personal care and his personal evaluation?
Yeah, so you're onto a really important question about the benefit design and the insurance framework, which
would... in the sense of data, I understand the optimization question, the choice thing.
Yeah, on the data rights.
I'm talking about on the data rights to the foundation for the supposedly, and let's say it is,
yes.
Logical decision.
You got it.
Nevertheless influences your life.
So the reason why you are on the body that you're on is that there's a floor and a limitless ceiling to this conversation. The floor is stage 3 certification requires a certain piece of information be made available to the patient, no more, no less. That's the floor. And the patient may see their blood pressure was this, and their, basically there was no next step. There was no order to test, and so it'll be blank. I had an elevated blood pressure, but they didn't do anything. And all I would know is that. I wouldn't know the logic that led to that course of treatment. What the president said in January of 2015, when he launched the Precision Medicine Initiative, he made a very bold statement. I will paraphrase the quote because it's not in front of me. He said, I want to see a world where patients not only have access to their raw data, but the ability to connect their data to applications and services that can help them make sense of it. In other words, let me play the story out. Walgreens. Walgreens says to patients, I'll give you a digital second opinion. That Dr. Barrett guy's a crook. You give me the data that you're legally entitled to. You connect my Walgreens app to the Dr. Barrett portal that determined what he or she had done to you and the information about you. And we'll tell you, based on our research, that people like you are better off if you pursue this course of treatment. That digital second opinion, aspirationally, is exactly the marketplace that is evolving. And this Inova Personalization Center is going to be making billion-dollar companies whose sole purpose will be, give me a digital copy of your data, give us your saliva, do something, something, and we'll tell you more information about your situation to guide your care. I don't care if you're a VCU patient or a whatever patient. VCU may not offer the Inova Center a B2B information exchange method because it's not required and we try and it's not, maybe it'll work, whatever. But VCU is obligated to give it to the patient who may choose the mobile app that Inova will put in their hands to say, we'll give you that. We've amassed the world's knowledge into a chip and we'll give it to you in the Amazon cloud and all the great things will happen. That's this chapter of care delivery.
That's fine if we can agree on the data. Okay, I mean, it is possible to disagree, like the old political thing, it's possible to disagree on the conclusions, right?
But you're absolutely right.
But we have to be able to agree on the facts.
Yes.
And the facts in terms of evidence-based stuff. has to be a boundary on not the access to the data, but the access to the data in a, such a personalized form. So there are boundaries somehow that are going to evolve as a matter of use for the API. I understand exactly what you're saying.
Yes.
It's something that I've actually talked to Marshall about, but from the data point of view, not the competing conclusion point of view.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There is a very interesting sort of inch off the ground stone castle being built here.
Yes.
And I think it's a really important thing that be addressed.
I will make this in response to that comment. Separate the transmission standard from the payload. You're having a discussion about the payload. What is shipped? That's been regulated since 2009 in terms of the meaningful use core data set. And the forums to engage in the debate on what is the problem list, what is the meds list, what is the encounter summary, that's not an IT fight. That is a debate amongst clinical scholars and leaders who are engaged in a process to determine what a minimum common clinical data set is. That's a wonderful thing to engage on. I do not know if it fits the scope of HITSAC to weigh in on that. The question is that which is available. Now the question is the technical means of access.
Yeah, but I think that the technical means of access to data includes, there are technical data issues associated with what you're trying to push away from the technical side of things. There, API is just the access to the first layer of the technology associated with this information.
Yes.
Aside from whatever the current law has to say about it, or
yes,
current practice wishes. There are technical issues associated with privacy and all these things, and it's not clear exactly what they are, actually. I'm talking about from a technical point of view about the payload. No question I'm talking about the payload in the word. But anyway, I do think that there's I could just be ignorant, but I don't think it's resolved by where we stand. I just don't think it's resolved yet. The access to data has changed in a way that's fundamentally different than even 2008.
To make it really clear, and make sure I'm not misspeaking, when the MMIS vendor wins the award, and they have to meet the requirement that says beneficiaries have access to the data through a beneficiary portal, you have a choice to either direct a standard or stay silent. Silence means that you currently default to what's now available, usernames and passwords, which I would argue are massively insecure. Everyone knows it, and we're all scared about it. So the question is, silence doesn't necessarily mean that gets resolved on its own, because that requirement is in the RFP, as it should be, by the way. That's a statement about the... I appreciate whoever wrote that RFP wrote that in there. So that's a policy decision made by the agency. So the question to HITSAC is, given the choices in front of you, silence or standardize, what would you standardize? And I'm suggesting that your consideration be the FHIR API as constrained by the Argonaut project to address the very specific questions that you've outlined. There's a working group at the federal level, and I guess CA, I don't know what, I mean, you're only here for a short while. To some degree, HITSAC would benefit from some briefing on all the standards advisory activities. So there's a working group on API security and privacy that's been meeting for months, and they've issued their recommendations, and they've said unequivocally, this is a heck of a lot better, I'm overstating their language, but effectively, this is a heck of a lot better than usernames and passwords to portals. Hey, anything else?
Well, the other is, even after we, so I think this is something that Chris was getting at, but I want to be a little bit more concrete.
Yeah.
The payload.
Yeah.
In order for semantic interoperability,
yes,
to occur, the payload has got to be completely defined. And my
or documented, so that the developer knows what they're getting when they pull it from you.
Right. And my sense is it's not.
Ah, important question. Each vendor, under the application access requirement, must publish their developer, call it guidance,
okay,
which says, if you log on to this API, here's what you will get if you get patient, and then you get a response. The format and in this manner for you to use. The documentation is required.
But it varies by vendor.
You got it. So the choice right now is the Epic documentation will look different from the Cerner documentation. Except in the Sync for Science program, they've both agreed to the common Argonaut documentation, which means the responsibility is on Cerner and Epic to transform the data from their internal models into RxNorm and the other codified standard models. That decision has been made under the Argonaut framework so that when you look at standard choices that you have, you could demand a post-transformed data model. It's not going to solve all elements. It will for the 16 because there is a very table. There's a meds or RxNorm, and all that is clarified as to that particular payload.
And the order of the data elements is defined as well, I guess. Not only the reference terminologies, but the order in the file format.
That's right. You have to document how you're doing that. And in the Argonaut project, every day on the emails, people are just saying, how do we do transgender identity in the list for things that have to do with demographics? And there's a debate. Should it be unknown? Rank here? Like, these kinds of details are in the working groups who are out there trying to get to a common standard. And in the implementation guide will be the clarification as to the base minimum.
And you said, and you used the future tense. I think I heard you say the implementation guide comes June. Yeah.
It's already published. What they're doing is that real-time, agile, it's out there, React. I mean, this transgender thing specifically became an issue. Someone from Cerner said, I don't know if that meets the requirement. And then, how do we change it? Okay, well, let's change this. And it's all industry-led. There's no governmental dictate on it shall be this way or that way. And so every day they're iterating on each of the profiles, and the goal is to get everybody to get consensus by June, and that consensus will form the versions that are being shipped for Sync for Science later this fall in pilot form, and will be the basis, we hope, of what the vendors will choose to do when they certify, but that's their business decision.
Introducing the word hope makes me shiver.
It's the gap in the system. So HITSAC is ideally situated to close the gap by saying when we buy software, we want it in the post-transformed, defined in this manner way. And today there is no standard. Yesterday there would not have been a standard for you to point to. Now I'm here to suggest to you that you have one to consider. It's the version of the HL7 FHIR constrained to the Argonaut implementation guide, blah, blah, blah. That detail, which is the basis of Sync for Science, is now a thing one could invoke. You may not wish to, but I'm here to suggest that it be on your list of things to consider.
Well, is there an alternative?
Not that I can find.
Right.
Not that I can find.
Right.
That's right.
Now, what's the you may have said this, but I want to make sure I understand.
Yeah.
Is there force of law behind the Argonaut project?
No.
No.
The force of law behind Argonaut was the vendors can do their proprietary APIs, and they all looked at each other and said, yeah, we can, or we can do it together. It's going to happen anyway. Let's figure out a way to voluntarily fund something to happen, and they all use HL7. So they said to HL7, what's our current time frame? And they're like, 5 years. I was like, this thing is coming to market in a couple years. We need to pull that forward. So the idea was hire a bunch of engineers, put some focus, and get the thing done in a year and a half. And so December of 14, it was launched. By June of 16, it'll be complete. And that thing is available for people as a business model to choose to use or not.
Do you or Aaron, do you know if the Argonaut project includes any of the data definitions or the information model for genetic information?
It does not.
Yeah, okay.
But certainly within the FHIR community writ large, there are ad hoc working groups thinking about the genomic profile, etc. I will note this. NIH will make the big Kahuna Coordinating Center award, theoretically this summer, we don't know, I can't decide when, and whomever is deemed king or queen will make these requirements pretty clear. So you will see a lot of standardization activity in response to what the procured vendor decides, not vendor, but it'll be like some health system, I assume either of you two applied for it, I don't know, someone is going to be the king poobah for precision medicine by NIH, and then we'll all kind of see where that unfolds.
Thank you.
All right. Good luck.
Very much.
You have one last, sorry?
No, Dr. Harrison.
One more question. So the discussion around the APIs is, at least the scenarios that I've heard so far, are about single patient data transfers, perhaps population data.
Got it.
Or outcomes of care quality and that sort of thing. Is there a scenario where these APIs can be repurposed for multiple extractions where we can get population data?
One of the most important decisions in the Argonaut standard was to define the user that gets access to the API as a / user, not / patient. So it's flexible to deem a physician a user. It's acceptable to deem an administrator a user. And that, like any API, you write that in the contract, in the API contract. If you present yourself as a user, we will authenticate you as a user. And the reality is, anytime you deviate from the one patient one at a time, you're going to require both sides to tango in the same contract. So if Inova wanted to do that with VCU, nothing in the world would stop them from using the exact same standard, just writing, think of it as a valet key. The valet key they give to the patient works in only one use case, but the valet key between Rich and Marshall might have for attributed patients that are, you know, through some other identity matching, initiate funded, you know, connection point, they'll do some roster ID, and so there'll be a third API server called the roster reconciliation API, and it'll only deem that those information records can show. Nothing stops you from incorporating those off of that core standard.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't asking whether it's technically possible to extract multiple patients, which I know it is.
Yeah.
But whether there are other barriers that we're going to need to face for that. Of course, there potentially is no reason why we shouldn't have a single patient identifier, but we don't have one. Is the population extraction a scenario that's actually being considered as part of this advance in communications, or are there barriers to that that we're going to need to face?
I can't speak with certainty, but I would suggest that this is an amazing topic for Virginia to discuss. Nothing in federal law prohibits Dave Burhoff from voluntarily assigning a patient ID. And for any of the advanced directives work or any of the other things that are sort of public health oriented, when my kids have their immunizations stored in the registry, I today have no, at least I didn't think I did, have API access to my kids' immunization records. I'm going to go back and now check. Thank you for that update. But to the extent that that's available, I will happily take advantage of it and would love to start seeing these other use cases flourish. You would then reconcile what does the approach to said architecture work, and does there need to be this plumbing procurement? In fact, it might be a great setup for Michael. Maybe that's a great role for Connect Virginia to help basically stitch together what is a Connect Virginia approach in a world where everybody's got API level access. Maybe they don't need record locator. Maybe they need reconciliation across connected apps. And I'm sure Michael's got a team nationally thinking about this whole concept, because every HIE in the country is reimagining themselves. How do I manage a world where everybody's got connected point-to-point API access? What do I offer as a value-added service? Attribution list. In the state of Michigan, the HIE is the master repository of attribution. So you might say, here's the list of doctors that patient has seen. The valet key across the network will be, as long as you're on that list, you get access to the data. That may be a phenomenal role for Connect Virginia. It probably already is. I don't know. Other HIEs are similarly thinking about their world in the Fire API universe. All right. Good luck.
I know you're rushing to the airport. Thank you for your time.
Got it. My pleasure. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yes, Ms. Connery.
I did just want to mention in response to Jim's question that from a population health perspective and public health perspective, at least from the data that we collect on behalf of the public, there are most definitely code, and they may be antiquated. I'm not, you know, not to say that they're not, but there are most definitely regulations, law, and code that would prohibit the population piece, unless it's specifically identified as a reason you would receive that specific data set, as you know. So that's certainly challenging today when you do data sharing agreements, even if you set up SFTP sites and transfer data to people. It's challenging today.
Right.
So with an
Debbie
API,
and I talked about this issue before, and if we're going to establish these APIs and we're going to create this individual data sharing, we need to address the population data sharing too. It needs to be done correctly, and the interests need to be protected, the patient interests and so forth. But there is a real opportunity here that you could extract into a better understanding of population health and potentially improvement for a variety of different improvements
right.
for the Virginia population. But we need to get that right, and I would really like to see that be part of the discussion along with the individual data extraction.
Well, I think based on your request, it will be. Absolutely. Thank you, Anish. Safe travels. All right. Well, I think it's the appointed time for recess for lunch. So we will recess until 1 o'clock. And, our speakers and members of HITSAC and staff attend lunch. The public does not attend the lunch.
There is a cafeteria down the hallway if you're interested.
Well, I think we ought to start. I mean, I think it's the appointed time. Well, we can't start yet, David. There she comes. There she is.
I'm here.
There you are.
The woman with the information.
As a matter of fact, while we're getting the slides set up, I've asked Michael Matthews to give us some comments based on what he heard from Anish Chopra. So, Michael, you can take the podium and we'll... Are we recording at this point?
Yes, we are.
Okay. You're on.
Thank you, Dr. Ruffin, and it's good to see all of you again. If Anish is fire, I feel like I'm going to come across as a bit of a fire extinguisher. That's not really my intent. You know, fire has a lot going for it. It holds a lot of promise. I think some of my concerns I want to share is around how much investment there is in fire as a single solution for all the world's challenges with interoperability. So what I'd like to do is just share a little bit of context and a few concerns to put some of that, to react to some of what Anish had to say. You know, first of all, I'll say, of course, there's a lot of courses to Anisha's comments. Of course, consumers need to have access to information. That's the only way we're going to move forward. Empowerment by the patient and engagement, population health, and all of that. And the first thing I would say is I'd like to differentiate between consumer-mediated exchange from consumer-mediated access. All right, when I hear consumer-mediated exchange, that implies to me that the consumer-mediated exchange is the only mechanism that's going to be used for exchanging clinical information between and amongst all the relevant stakeholders in healthcare. Anish listed out the three approaches to interoperability with the directed exchange and the query retrieve and consumer-mediated. And I think that the directed and the query retrieve still hold a lot of value. It depends on what the use case is. We're doing some very interesting things in utilizing direct messaging for referral coordination, for example. There's a platform that we'll likely be implementing that allows a CCDA to be parsed out and support referrals going from primary care to specialists. So even though it's not that sophisticated, it still has its utility. Query retrieve, we're seeing a lot of ongoing continued value, particularly in exchange with federal agencies, Social Security, the VA, and Department of Defense. But and I think that the B2B still is meaningful. You know, the physicians who have helped craft our foundation and policy work, you know, they have been very consistent in a few premises. One of those is if they don't know what they don't know and what's being exchanged, they're not going to look at anything. In other words, if a consumer has blocked a particular piece of information, the piece of information they blocked and the reason they blocked it may be more important than what information is conveyed, causes concern around that, and most would just rather ignore whatever data remained available. So, again, consumer-mediated access all day long, get the information, and it's easy of an API type of infrastructure as possible, but let's not, again, kind of throw out these other workable mechanisms. I would point out a couple of things related to consumer-mediated exchange as that advances in our ecosystem. CMS has four basic actions that they believe a patient needs to be able to take with respect to their data. Number one is be able to view their health information. Number two is download their health information. Three is to transmit their health information to a third party. And fourth is access their information through an API. Okay, so I think those are important features regardless of what the mechanism is. There is an alliance for consumer-mediated health information management and exchange that cites the following barriers to consumer-mediated exchange. And it all involves a lack of consensus on consent management protocols, governance, operations protocols, and pricing. Those are not insignificant concerns. Consent management protocols, governance, operations protocols, and pricing. And to those, I would add a few more. The identity proofing of individuals to assure that they only access information they are authorized to access. How will the correlation be done to correlate the identity of the consumer with the patient record number of the EHR? An important element in any kind of health information exchange is the distribution of liability. That is the foundation for all trust agreements, the data use and reciprocal support agreement. So what is the distribution of liability if the wrong information is accessed or exchanged between consumers and providers? Is it the API vendor? Is it the consumer? Is it the provider? Is it the vendor of the EHR on the provider side? I'm concerned about the increased management burden on the practice to manage APIs and data access. They're burdened enough as it is. Workflow integration with the practice and how to scale so that the data are readily accessible to providers when and as needed. So again, there are some mechanisms to seamlessly get information like results, routing, and counter alerts, and even query retrieve in a fetching mode into a physician's inbox all the way into the patient chart. How will that be impacted if the consumers are the source of that information? Trust is always the most significant factor in the effective exchange of health information. Will providers rely on information that is consumer-generated or even consumer-mediated? I know of personal health record vendors where an actual lab result, the lab value can be transformed from a reference lab on the way. A prescription medication can be changed in dosage or type as it's being conveyed over to the providers. I would add one more, and that is, what about the consumers who don't have the capacity to mediate their own exchange? What about consumers with multiple chronic diseases?
The majority, I'm afraid.
What about those who lack even the basics for digital communication? 46% of seniors do not have a smartphone. Okay, I think my mom and dad are as tech savvy as any 86 and maybe 87-year-old consumers out there. I've got this delightful picture of my mom teaching her great-granddaughter how to text message. But the prospect of them mediating their health information, 20% of seniors have five or more chronic conditions and see 13 different physicians during the course of a year. People draw an analogy to the bank. Well, most people only do business with one bank. They don't do business with 13 different banks and a bunch of different savings and loans. So with those, again, we are moving forward with consumer-mediated access, which is a good thing, population health, value-based care, all of that. But I think we also need to make sure we preserve what's good and build upon that in these other modalities as well. Thank you.
Well, let me, Michael, just let me follow up with a question. Do you see using the FHIR, could the FHIR standards be
interoperability with the system we have now. In other words, not necessarily consumer-mediated.
Absolutely, and I know with the Sequoia project, there's an active project underway now to use a Firebase provider directory and to be able to integrate that and leverage the capabilities so that you have an a specifically identifiable provider to go along with any messaging that goes through the query retrieve. So yeah, it holds a lot of promise for sure, even in the B2B context.
Thank you for your comments. We hope that you'll engage with us for the August meeting when we get into the details of this discussion. And we'll invite you to come back.
Blacksburg's a lovely place to be in August, I hear.
Well, August is in Fairfax.
Region. Even better.
Matter of opinion. Yeah, I would much rather be in Blacksburg than Fairfax in August, but just the way the scheduling worked out, Blacksburg is in November, when we may be freezing our tails, but we'll see. The foliage will be long gone, probably. Okay, all right, good. Thank you very much. Would you be able to put your notes in a written form so we can have them? That would be very helpful. Thank you. Thank you. All right, now, Dave Verhoff, we're looking forward to your discussion about identity management. We heard much from you about CSDII a year or so ago, and we're now interested in what's coming next.
Well, on the heels of Anish, it was very interesting hearing what he had to say with the Fire API. And I think one of his comments was, the human side in terms of authentication and verification of the individual is a mess, is what he said. This is what the IMSAC is charged with trying to straighten out with private vendors. Also government involved as well, but really kind of enabling those private sector markets to take charge of where this whole identity ecosystem goes. So I'll give you an overview of how the IMSAC came about. Oh, I got it. And so it was, I remember this is, I'll kind of put it in context as we go along, but, you know, Anisha's comment in regards to the human mess regarding authentication is what this is targeting, so keep that in mind as we go forward. So created by the General Assembly during last year's session, so IMSAC's been in existence. It came in July 1st of last year, and consists of 7 members and appointed by the governor, 4-year terms. We're hoping it's certainly not going to take 4 years for us to stand up an identity standard and guideline document. And members include representatives from DMV, and I fulfill that role, Virginia Information Technologies Agency, VITA, and that's Nelson Moe, and also Mike Watson, the ISO, as well as 5 representatives from the private sector. We've got Walmart, we have Telos, we have Capital One, we've got the Chertoff Group, and it's brought a lot of expertise to the table for us. So why was the Identity Management Standards Advisory Council created? It was pretty evident to everyone that there's these pocket markets of which you're talking about one right now within healthcare. Pocket markets of ID credentials that are being created by Department of, the defense industry. We've got higher education. We've got aerospace. All these different pockets, and that just creates more of what we're already seeing with, if you want to equate it to, the individual pockets of identity that we each have with every username and password that we've got with, you know, a Target account, your rewards program, your airline miles program, all of these different pocket markets of ID credentials. And it continues to grow, and as it continues to grow, it continues to increase risk. And this next statement here, this next bullet reality. And the fact that the more we continue to grow these pocket markets, and the more that there's a lack of interoperability between them, and you all with your API discussion earlier, you certainly are in tune with what the advantages are of interoperability. When there's a lack of interoperability, it really limits, when it comes to identity, consumer protection. Why? Because you've got username and passwords all over the place. So the barriers to adoption in terms of adopting a federated model for e-identity credentials was identified by organizations like Northrop Grumman and Verizon. They were asking the question, why aren't credential service providers able to get the e-credential into the hands of the average citizen? And they mentioned liability as being one of the biggest barriers. So all of a sudden, you have these pocket markets like Northrop Grumman with the defense industry, okay? So they've got how many? They've got probably about 8-9 million people, okay? 8-9 people versus hundreds and hundreds of millions of people when you start looking at the average citizen. All of a sudden, your liability risks skyrocket. So they turned to the legislature here in Virginia and they said, hey, is there any way that you all can develop something that would, if we abide by certain standards and guidelines, that would limit the liability in the event something goes wrong? So we saw that as, okay, if we go ahead and provide that, then hopefully you guys can jumpstart the EID market and put it out on a broad scale. So, all in all, the charge given to the IMSAC, and as well as the intent of the law, is to basically, and I think Anish touched on this too, is making the internet definitely a safer place in which to do business. And standing up those EID markets for the average citizen, that gives a lot of a huge value proposition to those organizations that are out there now. As I mentioned, limiting that liability through a common legal framework, and this is what that statute provides, and then establishing the standards and guidelines that that support that framework. So the responsibilities associated with the advisory council are codified under that particular section of the law, and we are charged with advising the Secretary of Technology on the adoption of those standards and supporting guidance documents. And it also involves the, we have to consult with the Secretary of Transportation as well. And that should have been added to the document because DMV is part of transportation. Now, what we'll recommend to the secretaries is our nationally recognized technical data standards, minimum specs, as well as any other related data standards or specs concerning third parties and how they would influence the entire identity process by which we document. So, we've only had two meetings, two formal meetings with the advisory council, and one of our members mentioned, you know, this is hard to get my arms around, and what exactly are we trying to target? So is there any way that we can come up with use cases that keep us aligned with where we need to go, what our target is? So we thought, okay, well, what are the largest industry sectors that would have a use case that our final standards and guidelines would have to align to and support? Obviously, healthcare was the first one that came up. Financial, business, you know, the banks, we have a use case for that, as well as emergency management type of identity requirements. Those of you familiar with NIST and the 800-63 regs, that would be level 4 for the emergency. You know, a lot of that. All right. So, we identified, Dr. Joe Grubbs helped me put this together. I know HITSEC knows who Joe is. And he laid out these requirements right here in terms of it has to be whatever we end up with. It has to be trustworthy, compliant, and of course HIPAA Secure to provide electronic authentication identity management for both patients and provider access to EHRs, electronic health records. So that's pretty much what you all were getting into this morning. You were talking about machine-to-machine, machine-readable authentication. This could certainly, whatever we come up with IMSAC, could certainly be applied to machine-to-machine, but for the most part, our first stab at this is going to be in terms of the human behind the patient and the provider. So the current state right now, you all build systems that are, you know, application-centric, you know, a closed network within iNova or whatever, and Valley Health comes in and put those together. Nothing really that is looking to the outside for trusted federated identity. You mentioned CSDII, Dr. Ruffin, and we were going down that exact road. Where we are right now, we being the Commonwealth with CSDII, is that the Attorney General's office brought to our attention that Section 208 of the Transportation Code prohibits DMV from sharing information with non-government entities. So because we were, now you can do it through consent, but for us to set up consent agreements with what we were trying to achieve in terms of relying parties on a very broad scale, we knew that that wasn't going to work until we went another route. So that's why CSDII right now has turned to Experian and not the state, because Experian has no problem with that, and they'd love to sell you per record. So now, going back to that current state, the immediate result of what happens is when somebody sets up, like out in, what's the huge registry that you can go into on the healthcare? It's MyChart. Right, so you go out in MyChart and you set up your username, password, set up your account and everything. And again, this is what we were talking about earlier, the proliferation of duplicative, non-standardized, inefficient authentication mechanisms. I don't know. Now, MyChart's pretty well probably secure in terms of somebody breaking in and taking my data. But I don't know about some of these others that are out there and how secure they are. The long-term impact from that is increased risk and inefficiency, definitely threats to my private personal data. So, now keep in mind, this use case, we're targeting trustworthiness, compliance, and everything. So that means that when the IMSAC pulls together all of their various trust requirements for industry to use and enjoy that limited liability, as we pull together those requirements, we have to keep in mind the use case for healthcare and meet whatever HIPAA requires, whatever you all consider to be trustworthy. And if by the time we put our standards and guidelines document together and you all say this doesn't cut it, there's gaps here, then we got to go back to the drawing board. Because if we don't meet that, then our standards and guidelines can't be adopted by healthcare vendors. So, secure, standards-based, privacy-enhancing alternatives. So what do we mean by privacy-enhancing? And privacy-enhancing is largely related to a framework out there called the IDEF, which is part of the IDESG, which is the Identity Ecosystem Steering Group, which is under the auspices of NIST and NSTIC. Right. So the charge by the federal government when they developed the IDSG was one of, you know what, we just don't have a trust framework for identity out there that is really targeting privacy. So you've got other frameworks out there, InCommon, OpenID Connect, Open Identity Exchange, these other frameworks out there, but a lot of them weren't geared towards privacy-enhancing features. So what does that mean? So you all were talking about some of that this morning, in that you give control to the user, as Yanish was saying, so that they can control just exactly who sees what data. You also employ techniques and technologies like we were telling Dr. Ruffin with CSDII, which I still stand behind, that are labeled as triple blinding technology so that the various participants within an identity ecosystem can't see who's participating. Okay? So, now, there's terminology that supports this called non-linkability, non-traceability, and of course you're all familiar with minimal disclosure. But when it comes to non-linkability and non-traceability, of course, you know, a programmer, the first thing that you're going to think of, a programmer analyst, is, holy cow, you can't have a system that's not linkable in some way. So, but that's not the intent here when it comes to the IDEF. What the IDEF is saying is that, you know, your average analyst within DMV wouldn't be able to see, put the records together without having some kind of law enforcement requirement. The technology wouldn't be available to that person. You'd have to have multiple hands in it, hence the triple blind. So you go and you put it all together and everybody knows what's being done. So those privacy enhancing features, they run counter to the current way that applications are developed, in that it's just a closed world, it's just that pocket market. So the use case leverages the technical governance and business related advances that I mentioned a second ago under NSTIC. And of course we're going to be taking a look at the trust framework, which is in development by the IDESG for those privacy enhancing things. Now, are we just limiting ourselves to NSTIC and the IDESG? Absolutely not. Dr. Grubbs is actually putting together the document using 10 different trust frameworks that are out there in industry today. And he's putting that together. And the IMSAC will be the one that maps it back, making sure that all the use cases, business, healthcare, emergency management, and others, as we develop, will be satisfied. And at that time, I'll probably come back and talk to you.
I was going to say, when will that be?
We're hoping, we're on the fast track here, because industry is just saying, make this happen. We're about to explode. We want to get this out there and get the relying party set up through a federated model. We're hoping for that I could come back to you by the fall sometime. So maybe freezing in Blacksburg. So.
Dr. Barrett says it'll be very good weather that day.
It is actually great. Both my older kids went there and was able to still play golf, actually. So, who are the stakeholders in this? This is pretty obvious stuff to y'all. It's, you know, the EHR, operations and management staff, as well as security staff, so everything that we would do would have to be signed off on by your all security people, that's for sure. And, you know, the question came up regarding SEC 501, or which is the version 9 right now, but 10's coming, and 525, some aspects of the cloud policy. Would organizations that adopt our standards and guidelines, would they have to be compliant with the 501? And that is being discussed right now. So healthcare providers, both internal to your old healthcare systems as well as external, are considered stakeholders in this. Why? Because it's a federated model, so it goes beyond just your organization as well as patients.
Could you tell us which healthcare organizations are helping you refine the model, the standards at the moment?
That is none.
Well, because I would predict that UVA, VCU, and Inova would be happy to help.
Well, I'm depending on Dr. Grubbs to know who to go to through this organization.
Well, he knows the three of us here.
Terrific. We would love to have that expertise.
We'll help any way we can.
Very good.
Why shouldn't I'm sure. May I speak for the VCU and UVA when I say that? Thank you.
Always. Terrific. And I'm actually on the VCU IT Advisory Board. So
Tech as well? Dr. Bird has a question.
Whatever we can do. So this is kind of an inevitable question, so I apologize in advance. So since this is a problem that, you know, a lot of states are grappling with, is there an association for IM SAC-like organizations to work together to understand how these solutions, you know, are other people in other states in contact with this process so we understand what's going on more clearly? How are you connected to them, or did I just miss that? Or?
We're connected to them. We are not connected to them at all, other than what you could say would be national standards that exist now that we would be drawing from, such as InCommon, OpenID Connect, Open Identity Exchange, IDEF, other frameworks.
Do you think that from the aspect of things like people coming in, you know, mobility of people, changing states, changing systems, and maybe even, you know, business interests associated with making these kinds of things available to people would be benefited by having
an open forum?
Common approach. Or yes. Even a common forum to talk about.
Exactly. We started to go down that route. I wanted individual representatives from each of these frameworks that I just talked about, which are certified by the Federal Identity Credentialing Access Management. FICAM, you might be familiar with FICAM, which is the state level. I wanted people to come in and do that very thing so that we could come to, well, maybe not come to a common agreement, but at least learn from what they are doing and what they've learned. But we have been told to get on the fast track and to
lines of what I was saying, right, is that we're
drawing from an overarching identity framework that exists today, of which a lot of people draw down from. But to your point, we don't know for sure, so why not reach out?
Yes, Debbie.
Hey, this is going to be a stupid question, I'm sure, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway because I'm not understanding. So, what is the difference between this effort and CAS, the Commonwealth Authentication Service?
Very good question.
It wasn't a stupid question.
No, not at all. And I'm glad you brought that up. CAS is the Commonwealth Authentication Service System, which was funded by CMS. You all pretty familiar with it? Okay. Really, Debbie, there's no difference in that. That was a federated model that was supposed to be adopted by agencies. Unfortunately, due to high costs and a difference in opinion in terms of how it was to be designed, which, by the way, involves web services and APIs, which lend to greater adoptability by other agencies, those kinds of issues have resulted in the agency that was supporting it to pretty much call off the funding, and we were unable to get it into the agencies that would help to support the costs in time. It is a shame. Absolutely. In fact, we were going to hook CSDII to CAS, and we came very close to doing that. That was part of EC2. Why was that? Because if CSDII had the ability to go beyond the DMV database, because we only cover about 75% of the people in the state, we needed something else to cover that other 25%. CSDII was the gateway. So it's unfortunate what's happened here. Now, I'm trying to go down another road with another NSTIC, as you know, Debbie, another NSTIC grant with Fairfax County when it comes to immunization records. People right now don't have individual access to immunization records. Fairfax County has stepped up and said, hey, you know, maybe we can jump on board and use a federated ID out of DMV and have citizens and providers access the records.
I just mentioned that Fairfax gets those immunizations from the immunization registry at VDA.
Yes.
Yeah, so they actually contacted me the other day to talk about it, to make sure we weren't going sideways of the any kind of security or anything around the existing immunization registry. So you and I should probably chat about that.
Okay.
It's not anything that's not doable. No, it's not a showstopper. It might even play into this bi-directional work that Connect Virginia is doing for us, which we may want to all tie together instead of doing it separately.
Yep, I see convergence here. It's tremendous what's going on, and I'll tell you something else that's going to be converging soon is the fact that we're doing a lot of work on a mobile driver's license that sits on your cell phone. Okay, when you go into an ABC store and you present this, you're not presenting your driver's license anymore. You're just presenting something that's an EID that says you're of age of majority. That's it. That's an EID at that point. So it's really cool. You're absolutely right. We need to come together on this and make it work. Glad it's not a showstopper because the commitment letter's due tomorrow.
but essentially, CAS is moribund, from what I hear.
Shut down June 18th.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a real shame. I'd be happy to talk to anybody about the technology that supported it. Absolutely fabulous. As you know, the Initiate database was the EDM engine. We also had the CA Technologies that provided the risk-based authentication. But it is what it is. But we'll keep pushing forward.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so use case scenarios, you all are very familiar with these. You know, just trying to access that you're going to have first enroll a patient and then provide access to them across boundaries, so to speak. Same for the provider, across boundaries using a federated identity credential. So the next steps, engage subject matter experts in the healthcare sector, IDM space. So we looked at Dr. Grubbs as being our first source of expertise. I was in the healthcare industry for 15 years as a CIO for the Department of Behavioral Health here in the Commonwealth. So I know a little bit about some of that. I think the ICD-9 changed, is now ICD-10 and all that stuff, but for the most part, same thing. Identify and refine the use case scenarios around the patient-provider access. So we want to definitely work on that some, and we'll keep you all in tune with how we refine this. Then document the workflow, so really getting down to the detail and putting that in front of you as well. And then prepare a formal use case document. So in other words, I'm just kind of, you look at the last bullet point there, I'm pretty much bringing this to your attention that we're going down this road, and refinement will continue to be made as we identify more and more requirements.
Are you confident that the new architecture will be less expensive than the CAS architecture?
I couldn't be more confident, because right from the very beginning, if you recall, we were under a tremendous time crunch when it came to the Affordable Care Act, and the leadership in the governor's office at that time, they were under a lot of pressure to make sure that this thing was built in time to meet that crush October 1st, and with that came a lot of quick decisions that maybe shouldn't have been made. Okay, so I think that brings me to any more questions you might have. You're not eating your
lunch.
Thank
you very much.
Yeah.
Do you have any questions for Mr. Burhoff? Thank you for that update.
Thank you.
I'm glad to hear that you're optimistic that we'll come up with an architecture less expensive than CAS.
that will be easy.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, without any more questions for Mr. Burhoff, we're going to turn to a presentation by Aaron Black. This committee has dealt with genetic data several times. We spawned a genomics working group that actually Joe Grubb staffed, and Aaron was on that genomics working group. Aaron is in charge of informatics for the ANOVA Translational Medicine Institute, and Aaron's continued to work for the Commonwealth to help us identify and refine the standards so we can incorporate the information about genes and alleles into EMRs and into decision support. So we're grateful that you're here. Thank you very much, and take it away.
Well, thank you very much. As always, I'm very humbled to be here, especially at going to lunch with you guys. I actually probably might learn more from you today than you'll learn from me. But I do want to start off today, there it works, just giving a little introduction to some of my background, only because you can see the lens that I see things through. So I want to start there, but also talk about what we do at the Institute for Translational Medicine. So again, just give you context of some of the things we do, and then really work into challenges that we've had, particularly implementing a pharmacogenomic panel within the health system, and kind of dig down to that, some of the stuff that we see on the research side, and trying to translate that into clinical care at our institute. And then look at the opportunities. Obviously, with challenges, there's a lot of opportunities for us, for the state of Virginia, to work together to be a leader in this space. And then lastly, come up with a recommendation on a process. So there's so much that is a very domain expertise. I mean, there's a lot of different places that have to be part of this. It's not one person, one institute that can do this. So my recommendations are at the end.
And I might remind HITSAC that Secretary of Technology Karen Jackson, Secretary of Health and Human Resources Bill Hazel, and our governor want this standardization to occur because they believe with this standardization will come fertile ground for growth in the biotech industry, the genomics industry here in the Commonwealth.
And then obviously ask questions throughout. Again, I think I'll learn a lot as you see these slides. Personal backgrounds real quick. My background actually is in business, so accounting, management, information systems. I spent a summer in Europe studying international finance. So when I got out, I did a lot of consulting on the business end, mostly small accounting, but I gravitated towards data, different systems, accounting systems, management, I would call light distribution, light manufacturing, and then started to work for a startup company, moved to Columbus, Ohio, and they concentrated on billing systems. So I would actually go into mental health institutions and run projects where I would be hands-on running four or five of these at a time. So I got really good at understanding data and systems and also realized how messed up medical billing was. So in that world, you feel very comfortable when you match your accounting systems when things balance to the penny. And so I got very comfortable in that world. So in 2009, I started working at the Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus. This was about 9 years ago, on a project called the Cancer Genome Atlas, which is my first foray into research. So it was trial by fire, and I'll describe that a little bit. And then about 3 years ago, actually not quite 3 years ago, I was fortunate to come to ANOVA and be part of the ANOVA Translational Medicine Institute, and I'll go through that pretty quickly. But a little bit about my background, the Cancer Genome Atlas, which is here, it was really a consortium of different institutes. It was kind of piggybacked on the Human Genome Project. So a lot of the places that we had to interact with were the MITs, the Baylors, the WashUs, the big sequencing centers that were built. And for someone coming in from scratch and trying to build an informatics system, we were a biobank, so we all the tumors came through our facility. We built the laboratory system, we integrated the clinical case report forms, the pathology reports, and we built an integrated network, and the identifiers were, I'd say, quite messy. So really got, in trial by fire of trying to integrate this data across multiple institutions across the country who had their own expertise and their own standards. So I just wanted to frame that I have no hair probably because of this. So on the next slide, moving into ANOVA, so after the Cancer Genome Atlas, it was a contract for Nationwide Children's. I wanted to find a place that, you know, really I could leverage, you know, what I learned in building an informatics system literally from scratch and a team from scratch 2009 had started the Institute for Translational Medicine under the leadership of Dr. John Niederhuber, who before coming to ANOVA was the director of the National Cancer Institute, who actually had built a lot of the early infrastructure for TCGA. So I tease him a lot of times to say I follow him around the country to help him with his data needs. So in 5-6 years, we've grown to over 90 full-time employees, kind of a split between clinical, informatics, and the technical teams. So my group is systems architects, informaticists, clinical teams that support the infrastructure as well as the data that flows through our research studies. And currently, we have over 12 research studies, including, you know, large longitudinal studies. And the reason I say this is because we're dealing with a lot of the whole genomes, the big sets of data, and, have fought a lot of wars there too. So there's a lot of data flying around. Standardization is very tough, and we deal with not only, obviously ANOVA, but some of the people sitting in this room, their institutions, as well as places around the country, and are trying to collaborate because, again, not everybody knows everything about this. On to the next slide. So just really generally, one of the things that we deal with is actually moving data around our networks. So back to the standardization and the movement, we've already started to tackle some of this problem. And if my animations work, you can barely see this on the screen, but this almost looks like an integrated network. The up at the top left-hand corner is our kind of our research networks. And as I'm hitting the button, you can see things light up and they get darker. Because as we bring data in, so let's say raw genomic data, we have to process it. And there's standardized tools and processes that do that. So the data might come in at a petabyte scale, but by the time you process it, it's much smaller, much more workable, and we have to standardize on that because, we provide this as a service. So I'm a service. I provide this as a service to scientists, clinicians, and that route also comes down from the EHR. So we work with Marshall's teams at ANOVA to provide the clinical matching, so the genotypic and the phenotypic data together and having to match up all those IDs. And this is something we've been doing, again, for about 5 years now. I just came into the middle of that. So that's more on the research side, but there's a lot of data that is moving around of large size. But we've also started a clinical testing facility called the Enomics Genomics Laboratory. So we have the research engine, we have a CLIA-certified laboratory, and they actually passed their first inspection 2 days ago. They had the preliminary, but this was an actual auditor that came on site, so they're very happy. But today, we actually run a set of tests through the clinical system. So we use Epic as the basically the ordering mechanism. And right now we have kind of two different groups that we support, pharmacogenomics as well as cancer. And just to give you a little variation, we do individual pharmacogenomic testing for individual drugs as well as this panel, and I'll go into that in more detail. So for informatically, we have a lot to work on there. So integrating this into the health record, storing these as discrete results, and using the messaging, the HL7 messaging, to move this data around. And we also have partners in this. So we have knowledge base vendors. They're the ones that are the experts in a particular type of test. And I gave an example here of a company called Translational Software that we integrate our work with them because they're the kind of the knowledge about what these particular drugs do in the context of when we're ordering those. And so there's an interaction there that we have to actually share information with them, and they have to give data back. And that's kind of the evolution. So that kind of segues into the challenges that we have. And today I'd like to highlight this MediMap panel, which is more of the marketing name, but it's a pharmacogenomics panel where we're consenting mothers, so they have to consent to this test, but it's right at birth. And right now we are testing 7 genes and the pre-designated alleles, so they are FDA approved, so we have a lot of knowledge and a lot of backing on those. And those tests, this is the first one we've rolled out that actually, again, because we offer this to our infants or our mothers, as their Fairfax Hospital does about 10,000 births a year, this scale is quite a bit larger than your typical one-off pharmacogenomic test when somebody comes in for a particular type of drug. So we're actually doing this in a more proactive way. The babies don't have a condition, but because we're sequencing them and storing these results in the health record, we see value and utility by doing that right off the bat.
I'm doing 500 a month, 600, what's it?
Yeah, some right there. Yeah, and I think they consent about right now. We've been doing this. It rolled out in pilot, in November, and it went fully, I think, early this year, maybe February, early March. So we do reporting, and this is some of the stuff that we should talk about, because we want to see how many mothers are consenting and how many are not, and then reasons why they might not consent. Like, what are the issues there?
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
What is it that you're actually storing in the medical record?
We'll get into that. That's a good question. So actually, right here in the next slide. So a lot of the things that, a lot of the lessons that we learned, so we actually have formal lessons learned with our project management team, as well as, you know, all the people who are stakeholders in this. But in particular for informatics, the return of results are extremely complicated to interpret for people who don't deal with pharmacogenomics on a daily basis. So putting that in a format concisely for someone to understand has been, you know, the feedback that we've got. So we've worked, again, with a vendor. I mean, a lot of this is making sure you're comfortable with who you're working with. The vendor has done a really great job with us to turn these reports around very quickly as we get the feedback. So we have working groups.
And that's translational software.
Translational software. So these are PDFs at this point when we talk about this. These reports are PDFs. They're color-coded. The nomenclature has been vetted through our physicians and the people that work with them.
PDFs going back into the EHR, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So that's where we started. And what we're finding, obviously, is this is a very specialized area. So, again, that's why we need a lot of input from people in the industry. But what we found also is that and this is in general for EHRs, they're not really ready for the full panels of the pharmacogenomics. So the first thing we found out is everything that we did was customized, like everything. Right? This does not exist in the wild. You have to work from the EHR to the LIS to the processing of the data to the exchange, and obviously back to the report has to be looked at, and it has to be looked at for every test. It can't be just, there's some templates, and we'll show you some of the things that we found, but generally you have to put a lot of work and effort up front to do this right. And again, the standardization, all the things that we're working with, Marshall has been great with getting us in front of the standards for LOINC, and Molly Ullman-Coulier, am I saying that right?
Yeah.
And she's given a presentation here.
And she was, well, you may remember, she's made a presentation here. She was on our genomics working group, as was Aaron. You're also working with Clem McDonald.
Yes.
At the National Library of Medicine.
We'll go into that a little bit. So we definitely know that there's a need to standardize this stuff, and we're not by default the experts in it. Other things, you know, obviously we want to store the discrete results. We think that's the value in doing this. But overall, the data sizes are pretty small when you compare them to the research data that I showed you before. I mean, we're talking megabytes when you want to store the intermediate results. Stuff coming off the machine can be gigabytes at the scale. And so for right now, I think we have 100 terabytes that's sitting there for these backups right now. And it's redundant, so it's technically 200. So really quickly on again, some of these challenges, you know, taking a lot of this research data and putting it into clinical care, and these are my observations. So what you have typically is, you know, we want this data to look like this, so very codified, very much in a big way, and but sometimes it looks more like this. And we're not on either extreme typically, but just to show the dichotomy when sometimes, like my first foray into research, when I saw what they were doing, it was like, oh my God, the accountant in me went crazy. But, you know, this is the challenge. I mean, we can't do it all. We have to make sure we just do the right type of data and put it where it can be. So, you know, generally in the healthcare systems, you know, a lot of the, even today talking about, you know, what are you doing for standardization, a lot of that's driven by, you know, what can you bill for, the government regulations. And when we see the data on the research side, sometimes we think it's a little bit misleading and we really have to dig into it. And again, the EHRs for genomics are still pretty mature or immature, and they're wanting to work with us. And then the research side, you know, they love the concept, but it's so hard to implement because there's always something new. The research mind is quite a bit different than the clinical mind. So trying to bridge those things is really where I struggle and our team struggles. But in that evaluation, when we were doing testing, we did see a pattern. And this pattern is shown up here for pharmacogenomics specifically. And I'm going to put the data files up here because there was questions about data file size. So as you order the test, obviously that's done in your EHR. And again, think about plug and play. If you have Epic or Cerner, just plug your particular test or your EMR in here. Lab processing-wise, again, we had to customize that. So there are certain places that do this. That's what they do as LISs, but does it link to your EHR? So you want those two things to talk. So So back to customization, unless you have that embedded in one system, it's going to be customized. But in that lab, with those machines, you're doing base calls. And again, I'm talking about next generation sequencing. There's all different types of panels. There are different technologies. But for us, those base call files are what's coming off the machine. Then we read them, so left to right. Yeah.
Are those base call files unique to Illumina, or do all sequencing vendors adhere?
Some variation of them. They might call them something different. But, I mean, I'm talking about raw data. You're not going to do anything with it in the EHR with it, right? It's just, it's there. Now, the question is how long do you keep it? But, because that's probably the bulk of your storage right there, those files. Then you do the biological data QC, so it comes off the sequencer. Now you have to make sure that it's valid. You've got the entire file. Is it, you know, are all your chromosomes present? I mean, there's some certain statistics you have to do to make sure that that reaction went well and that the whole file is there. And then you align it. And there were some conversations about that today. We have to align that file in our panels, and then we create the variant file. And that's really kind of what we do most of the work off of, which is a BCF file. That's the dot behind it. So it's a standard file for this type of for next generation sequencing when they want to compare someone to the normal. Then that's when we actually send that to these clinical data places that do the annotation. So again, just having the sequence doesn't really tell you anything. You have to know what the literature and all the knowledge base says about that variant. What does it do? And again, that's got to be for the context of what you're ordering it for. So in pharmacogenomics, it's for drug-drug interactions. And then we have to generate an HL7 file to move that data around, and then eventually return those results back to the EHR. So it's a process, but as you go through this and you want to say, well, I want to do this for cancer, it's the same process. Now, the vendors might change, the machines might change, but generally it's the same type of pattern. And then if you keep on going down, it just gets more and more complex, and the data sizes get bigger. So that's really the pattern that we're seeing. And then there's additional functionality that you want to think about, because just generating the files and the return results, you're not getting the full value of storing that data. So the reporting and the analytics has to match. You know, is this actually affecting patient care? Can you measure that? What was it pre? What was it post? You know, this can help us drive reimbursement, right? So how do you know? There's the reporting and analytics that need to be done for this. Clinical trials, when you get into cancer, you know, we want to store it in a way that, you know, if we have some kind of interactivity to know that particular mutation or set of mutations, there's an active trial for it, that it'll alert us for that instead of having to go dig for it. And a lot of that, the standardization, I mean, there's a lot of places that are trying to do this or are doing this. Tumor boards. So, you know, again, a lot of the cancer is specialty, subspecialty. If you're dealing with a pancreatic cancer, if you're dealing with breast cancer, all these are different people that have specialties in that. So you can create tumor boards of different people around Virginia that are coming in and looking at this data together, doing the annotation, treating patients, and watching how they're doing, and doing this in an interactive way. So that's an opportunity there. The other one I put in here is third-party ordering. So again, for ANOVA and for many of our labs in the state, they don't do every single genomic test ever, right? You want to outsource some of this stuff. And most of those vendors do not send discrete results right now. They send PDFs and reports, and then those go in. So how do you kind of bridge those things so you get the value out of all your testing? Then research and data sharing. So if you're wanting to store this data in a central place so that you can share it, mine it for yourself, if the patient's consent to research, you know, you have to think about that. As well as, you know, what other types of integration do you want with the EHR? So clinical decision support, all the things that, again, discrete results could provide for you. Moving over just really quickly, and I pulled this from another document, but again, data sizes and complexities change based on the type of testing you're doing, and how you store those results will change based on the type of test. So the level of granularity, whether that's a gene name, whether that's an actual chromosome and its position, what were the observations, starts and stops, will change based on, you know, what test you're running. And the bigger the test, the more complex it is.
Bigger the test meaning the more genes?
The more variation that you see. So one of the things we did when we first were doing these was, well, we wanted to go to a standard, and LOINC was the standard that we had chosen. So the first thing, and this is just a screenshot off of my computer, We downloaded the online quiz. I'm a data person. I want to see it. So there's, 120,000 link codes. And there's a particular type that says molecular mutation type. It's just a filter. And all I did in here is I looked up one particular gene and said what's available. And if you can't really see this, but if you look at the document, they're all kind of ambiguous. Sometimes they'll just be kind of text. Sometimes they'll give you nomenclature for the allele. And so the standardization, even in the standard, is a little, not as defined as you'd want it to be. So generally what, and this is where we brought in Molly and Clem, and we were talking about what's coming next. So we saw the 2013 recommendations from HL7. They're now working on the next version, and I'm oversimplifying this, so bear with me, but it's for the visual, is that we're going to have to start to, the interesting thing is, for me as a person who deals with data, is the reference at the top is what we're comparing against, so kind of a typical person. The alternate is how that person you're testing is different than the reference. And so that change from one nucleotide to the other could be, again, I'm just making a simplification here, a blue, the color, that just does the color blue. But when you're doing two different alleles and you're trying to combine them together, what do you call it? Right? I'm not a geneticist, but generally, that when they're doing complex variants together, because it does something, how do you code it? Do you combine the two and make an interpretation, or are you combining each individual allele into a code? Right? So the way that we had been described on the phone to us was they're making combinations. They were doing the plus. But it becomes even more strange and complex when you do structural variants, where it's not just one change. These things are being rearranged. And then there's sequences in the middle, and it depends on the platform you're running. It depends on the analysis software that you're running, what version of that is. And so how do you make a call to that, and how do you standardize it when we're going to exchange this back and forth? That was the oversimplification of that is it ranges. And coming back to my Cancer Genome Atlas days, one of the first things that I thought was interesting coming into this world was they generated a 10,000 exomes for different types of cancers, and they would give it to the different analysis centers, so world experts, MIT and the Broad and Baylor. And I would go to these conferences, and they would be arguing over what analysis software caught what mutation. And this is a Venn diagram to say, here are all the different algorithms they ran, and here's what they found. And there's the reference down below. A lot of people were doing this to say, if I run it a different way, I get a whole different result. So again, we're trying to codify something, and the confidence really isn't there. That's why when we picked pharmacogenomics, we picked validated panels that were very well known. So there's always that. Generally, just to summarize that, when we look at how we have to store this data, we're going to want to know various things about them, about these tests. One being, what platform they ran. That was one of the first things that Molly had asked us, like, what platform is it? So we have to be able to standardize on what the platforms are. And those can range from, how deep are you sequencing somebody? So how confident are you in that placement on the chromosome? What's the quality? So again, this is a reaction. What is the quality score that you're going to make your cutoff point? So how are you going to filter, basically? Annotation. Again, these are very specific knowledge bases that are, go ahead.
When you use the word deep, do you mean the frequency with which you run the analysis?
No.
Tell me what the word deep means.
It means how many times, and this is actually a factor of cost. So you can when you do the sequencing, the technical discussion, you break it all up apart and then you put it back together, and then you measure depth of how many times how many times did you get that same letter, right? And how deep it is, the more confident you are it's the same letter, right? So it's a reaction that you're measuring. And I'm not an expert in that, other than that's one of the filters that they always use, is what's the depth.
But it comes, am I correct in saying it comes about because you're running the sequencing on the same sample multiple times to check the consistency of your results?
It's within the machine. The machine is doing that.
Right.
We're not running it multiple times in the same machine.
No.
It's
okay.
The way that they're doing the algorithm. And then also, there's validation sequencing. So if there's something that they find that is pretty, it has clinical evidence, it's going to change the way you do clinical care, they actually sequence it again at a higher depth. Right, because they want to double check they're not doing something that's, harmful with a low quality. So they'll double check it. They're not gonna, go on a low quality score. But that's up for interpretation. And the molecular genetics leader in the lab is the one that makes that call. It's not actually the software. The software just gives you the information. Does that clarify? Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Yes, please.
So I was quickly trying to look. I wasn't able to find very much because I was trying to listen and look at the same time. Didn't do either very well. But so I'm maybe missing something.
Sure.
So I understand that you keep track of the, say, the therapeutic condition under which these samples are taken and, you know, the rationale for having taken them and stored them, whether it's pharmacogenomics or cancer or whatever. And you're keeping all these things in some form that they can then be used for something. My question is, so there's a whole industry in analytics, like this widget, that widget, somebody else's widget. And so how does this system allow you to take, I mean, do you have to bring those widgets inside the system, or can you deliver the data to the widget, or does it ride on top of it and operate through an API into the system, or how do you have to, how hard is it to use somebody else's analytics?
Well, typically the, each one of these, again, is custom, so it can be various ways, but if you're talking about you getting it off the machine and doing the quality control, typically the vendor provides you with that, with their software to do that, at least in our clinical world. They do it, they version it, and then we have a second set of quality control that we have a staff of bioinformatics staff that does and goes and double checks based on what the molecular geneticist says. Hey, here's kind of the thresholds that you want, but that's all internal.
And so I'm talking about something slightly different. I'm talking about their advances in analytic technology itself, like how to compute this stuff, like how to extract information. That world is changing. That isn't just something that everybody knows how to do necessarily and build in. So it's, and there are products like that, and there are platforms, even not productized platforms necessarily, but like an NIH style.
Yeah, like GATK and
like
different things.
You know, like not for this, but like a BSC style portal, right? So this is, I guess that's the one way of asking this question. Is this organized like an information portal that you can then use information, or is it I mean, I realize there's privacy stuff, so you have to get inside that part of the system, but I'm talking about, from a technological point of view, is it that you have to get this whole process to accept a new method as new and then build it into the system to use it, or is it more flexible as a platform?
Definitely more flexible.
Okay.
Definitely more flexible than that. But each one of those has to be kind of looked at before we run the test. But yeah, very modular, if that's the question. Right. And yeah. Sure. And so annotation-wise, again, we use outside vendor for pharmacogenomics. We have that also for cancer. So they, when we provide them the variant file, they're the ones that are looking at that variant file, making, keeping the knowledge base updated. So that's not a function of the HR. That's an outside entity that we contract with that does that. But the vendors themselves, typically, when we look at, we ask them for standards, sometimes they're not, let's say, incentivized to do that. And sometimes we have to layer that standard for us. Now, our pharmacogenomics partner definitely is incentivized and wants to standardize. And then the analysis software itself, there are output differences, there are differences in interpretation. So, again, we want to be able to catalog these and put this as part of the test results that we send back to the EHR. Just really quickly, just to give you an idea of what the differences are, I just put this together. So, again, the account and me, when I first came to Inova, they actually had two different platforms they were running for whole genome sequencing. One was Complete Genomics, which now is no longer in business as far as whole genomes. They were out of California. They were bought by Beijing, by China. And then when they stopped servicing us, we went to Illumina. So if you look at the actual part up here, all I'm doing is doing a really quick matrix, very simplistic, of the number of files we get back to the size of those files. And you can see Illumina, which is in blue, is very consistent. In fact, that you can kind of see there's two clumps there. And actually what happened was Illumina gave us the same files twice. And so that's how we figured it out. It was like, well, why are they a lot of times this isn't consistent. The vendors are changing their platforms on us, and we have to keep up with them. And then even a more detailed level of that, what we've done on the research side, just to explore this data as we see it, is we've created a Hadoop cluster that we've layered with a system called Impala, which does SQL statements. So Hadoop can accept, you know, structured, semi-structured data, but we structured this with our partners at Institute for Systems Biology. And so this is just a very simple query for those who understand SQL. And what we found was the two different vendors, again, their variant calls were very different. So when we did even filtering on reference calls, and this is, again, whole genomes, it's much bigger than a pharmacogenomics panel, you see that the difference between the two of them is about 40%, the way they do it. And again, the bioinformaticists can handle this. They're savvy at this, but a particular group, maybe they don't. So just to give you an idea of the types of data sizes we're dealing with here, you know, we have put into the system about 8,200 whole genomes with those averages. When you put this all together and you look at the number of kind of data points that we're tracking, it's over 7 trillion data points, and that's only for 8,200 genomes. So if you're going to do this at a population scale, you know, just so you know. Yeah. Well, actually, when you compress it, and again, with these new technologies, you can get this down to terabytes, you know, single-digit terabytes. But the way Hadoop runs it, it does three copies, and I mean, there's all different ways you can do this. We're just saying this is the way that we chose to do this for genomes.
But what I find troubling, obviously, and you're referring to, is the difference between the two methods.
Yeah. And you have to apply your analytical methods and your interpretation to match the sequencing platform you're using, basically. But these were the same people. Some of these were the same people. Now, they don't match up on the columns here. But there's a paper written by Institute for Systems Biology against our genomes to show the differences of the two platforms. And it came from the same person, same day.
If you have time for just a brief, a little bit more detailed question, it would be of interest to know, are the variants in a common set of genes? Because, you know, the variants are sort of single nucleotides, and you could have a variation in what you're calling there, but if that, the impact of that would be less if those variants were called against the same set of genes.
Right, no, I agree. Yeah.
So did you look to see whether that's the case?
They did. I don't have, again, I'd have to look at that paper to look at that specifically, but most of these are just the spaces in between, right? The majority of the genome is not, you know, most of these calls are not in a gene right now, but, you know, as research furthers, now they're looking at the spaces in between and saying, how do they regulate the genes? I'm not here to speak to that. I'm just saying when we look at the informatics and we look at data sizes and we're trying to make sure we're validating this work, that some of these interpretations have to be looked at. Now, I don't know the exact size on disk. Oh, this is just the number of data points, not terabytes. I don't know the footprint of the data. Probably less than 20 terabytes, would be my guess. But it's redundantly stored three times.
Dr. Barrett, would you mind using the mic?
Oh,
that's right. Thanks. Because we're recording.
It's 8,200.
8,200, right. So that's
8,275.
That's a doable amount of data.
There you go. Okay, so the other considerations that we've had while we were doing this and that we should be thinking about when we're looking at standards is that the information that is coming in on a lot of these mutations and variants and structural changes is constantly being updated, and it almost depends on what is your resource, what source are you using for the truth. And it's very crucial that we are actually updating those and making sure they're up to date, those standards. So you might sequence someone once, you store it, those particular mutations, but in 5 years that might completely, there might be some other information that we want to gather.
Oh, that's exactly right. And any advice you have on what decisions you think HITSAC ought to make about those standards, we'd welcome.
Okay. At the very end, I give some kind of recommendations, but again, I think this is a group decision. In order to realize that, mechanisms. So then the other thing is, if you do keep it, you keep the intermediary results. Do you have a legal or ethical consideration to go and look if something new is discovered? Right. So if you store it for 5 years and then in the fifth year, here. I mean, you get where I'm going. I mean, what are the ethical and legal obligations to do that? And from a business perspective, obviously there's cost to towing this significant amount of data. So it's also somewhat a business decision, legal, and then how long do you keep it? Again, then what do you return as well? So initially, who defines what's clinically actionable in that context? You know, and that should be done, you know, upfront by the stakeholders for that test. Do you report variants that you know might be doing something, but you're not sure how significant? I mean, there's all types of things. There's conferences centered around this concept. Other considerations, again, how long to store, what are the costs as sequencing goes down, and they can, again, all types of technologies can help compress, and, you know, whatever services you're using, the cost will go down, but at what level? Especially if you're doing, you know, the larger data sets. And then again, should we start scanning results for major adverse things that are found? I mean, again, this is an ethical and legal question. So I'll drill down a little bit into the actual examples of what, you know, we're doing for our PGX, and then some of the things that we discovered by talking to Clem and Molly on HL7 and Link kind of codes. So for our PGX example, you know, we have the way the HL7 message is structured is, you know, at the very top is the name of the test, the version, and everything's hot linked here. So as we do want to send out the electronic copies, you can click it and it'll go right to the link page. So I included that in here. But then you can drill down to gene, variant, and the interpretation, and those are all there and they're all codified. And that's the way we are doing our pharmacogenomic testing, and we did work with Clem and Molly, who actually did some of these codes themselves, so they were some of the actual authors of these codes. But as we move forward to more complex panels, which is the next page, you know, we go from one test with one kind of gene variant interpretation to multiples. And so the pharmacogenomics that we're doing actually fits the second version of this. So we will repeat that type of messaging. On the third one, though, is that sometimes then want to actually interpret two genes together, or two mutations or alleles together. So it's not one or the other, it's the combination of the two, which again, how do you code for that? And right now, the way the standard is written is that you just combine the two together, and at the very top, you just literally concatenate. But these can repeat, depending on each panel, can be a little bit different, right? You can, you know, one group might want to do two genes, and one might want to do 20.
If you concatenate, what are the rules about which one comes first?
I don't know. I don't remember getting into that much detail with it, but that's something to ask. The documentation that we saw in the next version, then they get into more specifics. So again, for PGX, it was pretty simplistic, but when you get into cancer and other diseases where they want to track transcription, genomic locations, other optional things, and according to Clem, you can add these or take them away. They're not required in some respects, at least according to the standard that they're writing. But right now, again, you would have a test and you'd have a subset of variants that could have even subsections that did location and did the reference sequence and did all these things. And I don't want to go through this, but then each one of those systems is a code. So like Cosmic for Cancer, they have these specifications that they're recommending. And then I think this might be the last one is then what if you're doing complex variants? And again, you're then doing simple, but you have a roll-up of what those things mean. You might throw in some structural variants, and pretty soon these cancer panels, which a lot of times are very custom to that particular research institution, can be pretty complicated in its implementation.
Very complicated, and it begs the question, how do you search on those variants? How would you even find it, and how would you...
Well, this is back to the EHRs. They're not really set up to put it in like this.
Right? No, they don't have information models for this at all.
I don't know that I understand.
understand it either. I can't. What they're trying to do is represent a unique combination of alleles, right, that may have a particular significance in the protein or proteins they produce.
Right, but yeah, what do you call that overall?
What do you call that, and how do you calculate on it?
Well, how do you? I mean, what do you look for? What are you looking for? I mean, you're supposed to be looking for something. I mean, you just made that up. That wasn't in there. You see what I mean? It's like, I don't understand what it is. Well, I don't understand what it is analytically, but somebody, I could be taught. I mean, this is maybe something I don't know, and I stipulate that I probably just don't know.
Well, I admire you for admitting that. I don't think I know enough to know that I don't know.
Right, and we've only seen this very recently as well. Like, we don't use this, by the way, yet. So if we go on to, I'm actually going the wrong way. Yeah.
Find in other, I mean, there's lots of other gene databases, right, that without getting tied down into particular, like, discussion about cancer, I can go to a bacterial database or a viral database and say, what do you do with the, you know, mutants and alleles and stuff? I mean, what is it that you do with that? And I don't know what they do. I mean, I do know some of the stuff they do, and it isn't that, so I don't know how you handle. I just want to say I don't understand that, but if it looms large in the, somehow in the information, I mean, it seems to be a lot of going back to this issue and I'm not understanding the issue. I don't understand why this is so important or even what it does. So I have to find out. But I think it's a serious, I mean, there is an issue. Let's talk about mutations just for just 1 minute and I'll just leave it at this. I mean, it's not clear just by looking at a mutant or an allele, actually, what it does to the fitness of the organism or the, you know, proteomics downstream or something. It isn't clear just by looking at it like that. It's a complicated question. You wouldn't just make a bunch of mutations and just string them together and I'm not, you know, you see what I mean? It's like, I don't understand what this is. So I can't ask a question then and just set a thing. This is like, what is this? So what's the, aside from whether it's done or not, which it is done, but what's the sort of objective in doing this? It's just to capture what people are already doing. So it's just stored. So somebody else decided to do that and you're just figuring out
how
to store it.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Well, see, that's the issue. So I'll go find out.
Yeah, but yeah. Absolutely. This is storage. And again, there's a lot of interpretation in these codes that are probably, as you dig into it, hopefully it'll become more apparent. So I gotta go the other way. So opportunities, and I think, you know, right now there's a lot of consumer demand for this testing. I mean, I think there's a reason why you know, the state of Virginia is interested. There's a reason why ANOVA is interested. There's a reason why a lot of your institutions are interested in genetic testing, and there's a lot of demand for this. My next two slides really were meant on the opportunity side is that our population, the population that in our studies, if you look at this, you can't really see it on the map, but it's actually a picture of the state of Virginia or Northern Virginia area, and the purple, the dark purple in the middle is a 5-mile radius around the Fairfax Hospital, and then everything else around it is another 10 miles and another 15 miles, and that is where our consented research patients are coming from. So we have about 10,000 that's represented here because that's one of our cohorts. So we know when we consent them, we know where they live, and this is just a representation really for our clinical groups to understand kind of our patient population. That was when they enrolled. This is what they did when they enrolled.
But what's the difference between the blue and the green dots, do you recall?
Just how far away they are.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, so it's kind of a central thing just to give you a little bit of context. It's about a 5-mile radius, but in the next example is where they are now. So when we consented them, they were very obviously tight to the health system because that's where they had their infant. Now they're located all over the country. So, you know, if we're storing these results and they move to another state, they move to another place in Virginia, again, what utility do we have to store these results? And that's across, you know, not just genomics, it's across everything.
Right, and what obligation do you have to contact them with new information?
Right. So they're moving across the country. This one actually I took almost exactly from Molly's old, because I like the way she put this. So what are the opportunities to do this and put this into the clinical record? You know, obviously, you know, to start to personalize our care, to prevent and to be more precise of how we're doing it, to focus on specific risks to specific patients, you know, increase that surveillance so if we're tracking it, we can track them over time. And really just to improve our whole decision support system, which is that second bullet point, and do it in a timely manner. So if we can store it and not have to go back and go search for it, it being more near time, we can improve that support. And then overall, hopefully reducing the healthcare cost, which I know is on the forefront of everybody's mind. The other thing is, and I pulled this particular graph from a study by the Institute of Medicine, this is about 2013, and what this shows is the U.S. compared to 19 other countries that are very similar to us as far as economy. Like, you know, the U.S., if you compare us against the world, we're going to do very well in healthcare, but if you compare us against the people who are financially similar to us, this is the mortality rates by age. And if it's higher on the graph, it means it's better. And so if you look at the U.S., it's from 0 to about 55, we're probably the worst. Go and if you can make it to 65, you become the best. Right. So that's.
So Medicare's fixing everything. That's it.
Right. So there's where you're, you know, it's just an interesting graph. When I saw that, I'm like, that's interesting.
Actually, I've never seen that before. That's really quite interesting.
So cost savings, obviously, you know, the benefits, if we can start to store this in an effective manner, we can save costs because we don't have to run the test again. So, you know, the other opportunity is just to run the test again. You know, obviously, if we standardize this stuff, we're going to save computer time and staff time to put these things together. You know, if we can exchange it between like institutions and multiple institutions don't have to run the same test, because this should stay with you. I mean, this stuff does change, but not much. And obviously, it grows the more
we gather. When you say this stuff changes, is that a technical term? I mean, there's stuff.
Well, stuff is that, I mean, when you sequence, some of the genetics, they're finding, you know, changes. I mean, as you age, it changes slightly. Again, not my domain expertise, but that's some of the things that we think about. You know, at some point in time, do you want to resequence people as opposed to having to store it for 20 years, right? And then obviously to standardize those return results. So what's the return on investment? If we want to, you know, doing genomics in a clinical setting, I know the dollars that it took to get that up and running and the expertise that's needed. You know, if we can have some kind of benchmark of what it's going to take to build tests like this to drive some of the reimbursement to help, would be good for us.
I think actually it's public knowledge that Inova spent about $30 million a year for the past 5 years doing this.
Yeah. So obviously Virginia could become a leader here. I mean, obviously we know the standards, to everyone's point here, are still immature. They still maybe don't make sense for broad use, right? So being part of this actually I think would help drive a lot of the things that we might not think are correct, because, you know, I think that's an advantage we would have. Consortiums, obviously you have, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a challenge to my three other members of HITSAC, but I think it's such an interesting question, how we take these data from pharmacogenomic testing, in particular because it's immediately clinically relevant, attach it to the EMR, and store it in such a way that we all can share it so you don't have to keep resequencing people.
Yeah, I mean, we just recently did some work in that regard because, likewise, we have some high-throughput sequencing systems in our lab, and our EMR Cerner can only absorb a PDF output report.
Epic's the same way?
Yeah. What we did then is we actually use our data warehouse, and we pull kind of the sub, yes, parallel system there. It's not the EMR, it's not in, you know, the physician's workflow necessarily, but it's a first foray into being able to patient-specific co-reside clinical data with sequencing, you know, actually numeric sequencing data. And we'll see where we go from there. It's pretty new. We've only been doing this a couple months.
I mean, I think we'd be very interested in what VCU and UVA are doing, how you're storing these data in coded form.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the major purposes of this discussion, see if we can't come up with some standards so we can share it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, population health management for genetics and genomics combined with the other data that we're capturing, I think is something that a lot of, you know, PMI, that's a lot of what they're, you know, they're trying to promise, is storing all this data into a central area to do, you know, again, does it look like America type of populations? So can we do that for the state of Virginia? And there's a lot of public-private partnerships that are going on investing in this. You know, we obviously with our new Institute for Center or the Center for Personalized Health, there's a lot of interest in that, right, for public and private partnerships. Technology, obviously, if you can do this, then there's definitely a gap in the amount of people, talent in the IT, informatics, medical space that can do this type of work. If we can become a hub for this, back to, you know, driving economy, I think this is a really good avenue to do that. Because I know personally, when we try to recruit some people to do this, it's very difficult to find them, especially with all the technology changes.
Well, I know the leaders of our organizations are want us to collaborate. I mean, so Inova's working with VCU right now and the School of Pharmacy and other things. We have house staff and many research projects with both organizations, UVA, VCU. It makes all the sense in the world for us to try to help all the organizations in Virginia reach standards so we can use coded data to and machine learning to predict the future with or as Dr. Barrett would say, explain the future with better resolution than we can now.
Right. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for Virginia. And again, a lot of momentum. You know, obviously, I see it every day now. My news feeds of different consortiums, academia, venture capital, philanthropy, putting money into this type of work. Consortiums. I think we're part of a couple consortiums, and again, within the state of Virginia and outside of the state of Virginia. And then really just optimization. So the better we can work together, I think there's a lot of optimizations to doing that.
Are there other states from whom or from which we can learn? I mean, is the state of Washington ahead in this sort of area? Is the state of Massachusetts ahead? Does anyone know if
there might be some information from the Personalized Medicine Institute from PMI that could identify specific, you know, states that are ahead, but I can't recall any off the top of my head that sort of stand out as the rest.
I haven't heard of any. I think this is a pretty big challenge. It's pretty early to do that. It's immature.
And it requires a lot of money, too.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to have. So.
Not for the faint of heart.
Exactly.
And again, what we're finding now is that a lot of these vendors are trying to mature into our area. Like sometimes, like 5 years ago when we started, they didn't know much of anything, and they would just sell you something they repurposed for some other industry, and just actually were more of a sponge off of the people in our rooms, and they would go back to their labs and come back with something else that was, you know, version two. So, you know, 30% of my job right now is evaluating software. Like, they want to sell it to you. Is it really worth our time?
MediMap is what we call the 7-gene pharmacogenomic test that we've been doing on neonates for about 4 months.
But is it set up as a company? Is it a company inside Inova? It's a product line?
It's a laboratory test.
It's a laboratory test, okay. So collaboration and partnerships to handle some of these issues with either talent or ideas or something. That's possible. It's not going to be a proprietary or
Yeah,
absolutely. Both with Virginia Tech and UVA and VCU. We are very eager to collaborate. How many mini maps have we done? A couple thousand, probably, haven't we?
Yeah, a couple thousand.
And we're offering it now to every newborn, and if I recall, about 80% of the parents permit it. Yeah. It's a cheek swab. There's no bloodletting. And we're soon going to offer it to the parents as well. And you're rolling out a multi-gene test of, how I say you, the Translational Medicine Institute, although Aaron has a lot to do with it. But you've got another test coming with how many genes? 35?
Yeah. Right. Yep. Yeah. Again, but they're all custom. You know, they pick their 35, they vet them, and then they go. So yeah, definitely open for that.
We're very eager to do that.
So just to end up here today, because I've taken enough, I think, of time, but it really is to think about what's the next step. So we talked a lot about the challenges and some of the opportunities, but what could we do tangibly as next steps? And we'll move on to what I'm proposing is really three steps. One is to organize and find, again, subject matter experts in a various number of areas so that we can kind of talk about these across not just informatics, but across the applications, across how we can share and answer some of these questions. So, you know, pulling together this group of hospitals or labs to say, hey, can we get together and talk about this in maybe a separate subgroup like we had started with the subcommittee, and then have people that they bring to the table that are, you know, in the lab, in the clinical space, into informatics, as well as, you know, the government representatives, state labs, and then these, what we call external experts for HL7, for Loing, so they can be at the table, as well as even software vendors, because at the end of the day, they play a pretty pivotal role in how these things roll out, and then can help. As if we do it right, they can start to service more and more effectively in this maturity model. And then once we have that, you know, create this cross-functional team once the decisions are made, and then select, you know, one of these tests, one of these simple tests, not going into the complex ones because it might be too immature to do, but maybe talk about them, but pick one or two tests, and then actually, you know, whether it's a Nova-type PGX or pharmacogenomics test, if there's other tests that these institutions offer, is to actually go in and make recommendations to find the standards and see, you know, if we can come to a consensus of how we want to implement those. And really, you know, look at the different coding standards from HL7 to Loing to Cosmic. How do we exchange them? I mean, think about all the things that we'd have to do in order to make this effective, not just running the test or storing them, but then how do we report on them after we've actually done them? So are they effective? Because just because it's the new shiny thing that might be happening, it's only going to work if it's, you know, it's effective. And can we start to get reimbursement? What are the return on investments of doing this? And if we start small and agile, and then can move through the process, and so as the complexity picks up, I think we'll be better suited than trying to tackle, you know, something that's really, really complicated at this point. And then, you know, really just trying to then, as part of that committee, as we're rolling this out, is to look at the other use cases. So almost have a list of things as you guys see other types of use cases. So I think newborn screening or newborn could be one of them, right? Some of these other things that are happening, we could be looking at the standards of how to roll them out and implement them into this committee. And then obviously not just next generation sequencing, but other types of diagnostic and prognostic tests. So generally, the rationale of the process is that, you know, we definitely need, this is complex. There's a lot of, you know, questions from all over the board. We need to have, you know, different experts from different disciplines. You know, agility will be key because these standards are changing at times, and we have to adapt to those. Obviously, we want to start simple because the standards for a lot of those simple tests are more defined. And then applying those standards to at least a couple of these to do it in the real world, because the standard's only as good as the implementation of that standard. And we'll learn a lot from doing that, and hopefully create some momentum. And I think in general, I think this is needed if this is going to be a success.
Thank you very much. So essentially, what you're suggesting, correct me if I'm wrong, on slide 42, so we should be back about three slides, for number one, so two more, you're suggesting that we build
identify the data specifications for tests. Coded data, obviously.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And then you're suggesting on the next slide, create standards for at least two genetic tests. And that would get us in the rhythm. And then as more tests would come along, we could standardize them as well.
Right.
How do we do this? So first of all, I think it's great. And Virginia ought to do this if the other 49 states aren't. But assuming that the other 49 states or some of them are doing some of this, how do we coordinate with them?
I don't know. I mean, how would the communication mechanism, how would we know they were doing it? Is it going through a CLEM or some national standard that they're also talking to them?
Well, I must say, and I think you've just given the answer. I mean, CLEM would know, at least from LOINC, and Jim would know HL7 and LOINC.
Or the software vendors would know. Well, the software vendor, like a translational software, would know other people who are trying to do this, right?
Right.
There could be other ways we could figure it out. Because, yeah, if there's another state.
Yes? Would you mind coming to the mic so we can capture your comment?
Did Molly mention something about her institute, the cancer institute that she worked for MIT, working with different groups across the country on this for genetic data on cancer?
I believe so. She actually has left the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and she's now with a startup company.
Okay.
But she's still involved with HL7, so I think it would be through HL7.
Okay, because when you mentioned about getting information from different states, I was wondering if that would be a way to...
It might be.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Barrett.
There could be a path through NIH-sponsored research, too, just through clinical trial data and other kinds of NIH-federally sponsored research as a public use requirement, and there may be a large enough repository of data of certain kinds. I mean, I'm not sure, but if there were, you could coordinate around that from a technological point of view, you could coordinate around that, and then it would spread to the places that were off.
Aaron, correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to remember in the 1,000-plus Medimap tests we've done to date, about a third of the patients have abnormalities that would affect the prescription of common drugs.
That's about right.
About right. So if that holds true then for Charlottesville and Richmond and, you know, Roanoke, think about the implications of that. A third of the population would be served well. Of course, you never know which third until you do it for everybody, would be served well by having this test before they get antidepressants, statins, Coumadin, Plavix. There are a lot of common medications where we would change the dose, or the doctors would change the dose of the med based on the result of this test. That's
in you could envision, you know, how we have in our EMRs now rules that look at either weight or total body surface area or creatinine clearance as a determinant for dosing. And I could see this as sort of the next level up of actually beginning to apply rules based upon your particular genotype that is, you know, impacting those drugs. And there is actually a pretty good body of knowledge already about the effects of pharmacogenomics for whole classes of medications and drugs, but it's just not being applied.
It's not being applied, in part because the results of the lab testing come out as a PDF, and you can't drive any alerts off of it. There are 150 drugs now. The FDA says you ought to do the pharmacogenomic testing before you give it. Now, we're not. I think our 7 genes cover around 50 or 60 drugs, if I recall.
Right.
The 35 genes may cover all 150. But the point is, you've got the FDA saying you ought to do pharmacogenomic testing, but very few people are doing it because it's expensive and because we don't have any standards. And even if you get the results, you can't understand them. And there's no computer that's just going to simplify the result because it's a PDF. Well, that's
Those are all the issues we've been wrestling with, and it occurred, well, that's why Aaron's here, because we're eager to get the state of Virginia and HTSAC and the member institutions to think about standardizing this with coded data. I believe all the patients, all the citizens of Virginia would be better off if we could do it, and particularly since a third of them are going to have some abnormality that the doctors ought to know about. So now actually, thank you, Aaron. That was very nice. So stay there because I've got a follow-up question. How would it help the Commonwealth if just the institutions represented around the table standardized on pharmacogenomic testing and standardized on coded results? Would we get more clinical research dollars flowing in? I've got to take a drink. Would we have fewer injury to patients? What is there an economic reason to do this? Would we want to do it in Virginia as a state? So Dr. Harrison, what made you say yes?
Because you just named a bunch of desirable things. Ask, would we want to do those? And my trivial response is yes. The question I think you might be asking is, do we want to put together an effort to standardize? And one issue there, and one problem is that we're not, the national development of the standards isn't to a point yet that you can just pick the standards and do it. But there are several efforts, including the HL7 Clinical Genomics Work Group that we've heard from before, that are working pretty hard on this and are making progress. And so I don't know that it makes sense to duplicate and try to extend that effort as they're extending it. It may be worth just tracking those efforts, see where they are, and are they likely to come to a point where we can use it in the short term, in which case we may need to wait a little bit, but we'll have something that will be usable.
Or
I think the institutions are likely to be favorable to using these standards as soon as something workable is available.
Well, the question, I mean, we're actually, Aaron and others, we're already working with Molly. She's the co-chair for HL7, and Clem is very involved in HL7, and he's the founder of LOINC. And it's HL7 and LOINC that are really going to give us those standards, I would predict. The question I'm sort of asking is, do we want to be the alpha site?
Well, I think that the alpha sites are going to be the sites of the people who are actually doing this work and maybe 3/4 of the way done with it right now. But we could be an early site. I don't think that they're going to be at a loss for people to participate once they've got something that's workable. I would actually, on a related topic, I was going to say that in addition to data representation and coding standards, make sure you include, and Aaron alluded to this, there are important standards that we need for which files to keep, how long to keep them, and how to capture versions of the tools that were used as part of the pipeline to generate a result, how to capture that into the result, essentially a versioning process so that we know, for example, versions of knowledge bases and that sort of thing that are part of the explanation for a result.
Thank you. Yes. Are there any other questions of Aaron? Aaron, thank you. I thought that was very, very interesting and a nice summary of a complex talk, of a complex topic. Well, we've come to the end of the official agenda, correct?
Yes.
So now it's our time to ask for public comment. So we have two people from the public that either want to make a comment or ask a question. Well, thank you all for being here then. And I think, does anyone object to adjourning? Well, we're going to adjourn early.
Excellent.
So, all right, without objection, we're adjourned. Thank you. And then next meeting is in Falls Church, and we're going to get into more details.